This podcast is brought to you by Audible. Please visit audiblepodcast.com/GOT for your free audiobook download. Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 5, Episode 6, entitled Unbowed, Unbent, Unbroken, Unbelievable. Was it? What do you think?
Unbreakable? No, I liked about half of this episode. And I thought
half of it. Ooh, that's not much.
And I thought about half of the episode, and a quarter of the episode is just a real mess. Mostly the stuff happening in Dorne. And then... you know, there's a lot to say about the stuff happening up north. Anytime there's a rape featured on my show, the feedback is just incredibly depressing.
Okay. The show itself, kind of incredibly depressing. But
yeah, and then, like, you know, people's takes on it and stuff. And I'm like, you know, this is the fifth season. I'm not going to go into a lot of the stuff I didn't like about it. But I'm going to try to break it down into, like, I think there's four points of view on that scene, and then I selected like one email from each category to kind of represent, because that's the other thing, is like I got double the email this episode that I had the previous episode, which is already way too damn much.
Yeah.
You know,
wow.
If you don't get your email read, I feel bad for you, son, but I got 99 emails and I can't read every one. So but a lot of them are the same thing. It's a lot of Dorne sucked and here's why, and you know, Sansa's rape was a travesty, Sansa's rape was disgraceful, Sansa's rape wasn't that bad, you guys need to get over the whole rape. So that can all be condensed, compressed efficiently. You don't need to be Pied Piper to compress that feedback down to a few representative bits.
I feel like saying I liked about half of this episode is saying it's one of the worst Game of Thrones episodes.
Well, I mean...
Right?
Yeah.
How often do you think I didn't like any of that Game of Thrones episode?
I've never thought that.
There you go.
So half is an appreciable... You're right. It's not a majority. It's half.
Okay. Whatever. I don't have all the same problems that you have about this episode.
Hate this episode. Or is it Himmy hate? I don't know.
All Dimmy, of the above. Himmy. Yeah. It's your hate has a Himmy in it.
Yeah.
All right. I do want to talk briefly before we get into this about the previously on.
Okay.
Because, you know, Blast from the Past comes back here with, I guess his name's Gior.
Yeah.
Like Eeyore Mormont.
Sure.
Jorah's dad. Haven't seen him in a long time.
Yeah.
You know, it's what, season two?
Not since the Fookin legend of Jyn Ally pinned a tail on his ass. Eeyore style.
Or was that season three? It might have been season three. Either way, it's been a couple of years now. So it was good to see, you know, them giving us a reminder of who he is before they give the big reveal to Jorah.
Yeah, yeah.
And the other thing I noticed is, man, Tyrion looks so much different now.
So much different. Season one Tyrion, which was a good Tyrion. I thought he was a really solid Tyrion, but his essential Tyrion nature, it's like a good bourbon. Just sits in a barrel and starts evaporating. Finally just aged. Gets more. Yeah. You shove the dwarf in a crate. You ship him across a continent and a sea. Uh-huh. And he just essential impness consolidates.
Distills. Distills down into
there's
the
a word for that. You're right. Yeah.
Yeah, the quintessential Tyrion. Mm-hmm. So
it's the devil's was just... cut. We're getting the devil's cut of Tyrion right now. They squeeze it right from the wood.
Ugh.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on a series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
All right. Let's talk about who made this, and then we'll get into the recap.
Same as last week. It's Jeremy Podeswar and Brian Cogman. I wonder if some of the weakness of this episode is from Jeremy's lack of action experience.
Yeah.
You know, he's directed some episodes of The Pacific, which is that World War II Pacific theater. I've never seen it either. That. You know, I love Band of Brothers. I always wanted to get around to that. I never got to see it. So I assume there was action. Like, you know, every Band of Brothers episode had one action set piece. I don't know. But, like, you see a lot of, you know, 6 feet under, Queer as Folk. Stuff that is more character driven and less action oriented, because you know, a lot of things I didn't like about Dorne. Well, there's anyway, we'll get there.
But oh yeah,
that's one thing I was wondering, if there was a directorial style misfit. And also, I found out that they only had access to this water garden set for like 1 week of filming, because it's some kind of World Heritage site or I didn't get all the details of what it was, but I wonder if the complexity of trying to get everything done in a very, very compressed amount of time also led to some. They just did the best they could and tried to save it with editing. I don't know.
Yeah.
Lots of weird editing in this episode, too. Like, I don't know. Maybe this happens in a lot of episodes, and because I like this less, the flaws are more visible. But there's a lot of weird editing choices I'll talk about, too.
All right. Yeah. Point those out when we get to them, because I'm not sure I'm following you there. Other than that one scene.
Okay.
All right, let's start with the recap. We're at the House of Black and White. Arya is preparing another corpse for whatever they're doing with them. At that time, we don't know. Corpse removal crew leaves the door slightly open, and when Arya creeps up to it, she is caught by this horrible other girl who wants to play the game of faces with her, or Arya wants to play the game of faces again, and she lies to her about her past, or does she? She then asks Arya if she was lying, and Arya's confused by that.
It's a good week for Watts on television today.
And so she tells her, get back to work.
Gus Fringser. Gus Fringser out of nowhere.
Yeah, well, there are worse ways to Gus Fring someone. So she got off easy, I think.
It's a partial fringing.
Yeah.
He winged her with her fring.
I just wonder how many people she's washed. Like, it doesn't
seem... The washtage was pretty cool, yeah.
I mean, they just bring them in one after the other. Like, it's a never-ending string of corpses coming in there.
Yeah.
And you don't really see a lot of empty spots in the pillar room.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, like, what do they do? Do There's they get an overflow of corpses here?
A lot of
here?
People asking questions in the feedback, and we'll see what we make of it.
Oh, okay.
So I know she bitches a lot about having to wash the corpses, but I thought when they're actually showing her going about it, that she is getting kind of into the solemnness of it and the peacefulness and the reflectiveness of it.
Yeah.
Like, it's almost a meditation.
Sure. I think that's the purpose of it.
Sure.
She's just like sweeping the floor, you know.
Now, you said this girl's horrible. Why do you think she's... Why? I just thought that's interesting.
The Game of Faces stuff. Uh-huh. In a way, I think Jaqen is horrible. I understand she's trying to teach her the same lesson, but it felt like she wasn't... That was not her place to teach her that lesson. Mm. And that Jaqen was kind of mad about that.
Right.
The first time they tried it.
Yeah. I don't know. I think... One of the things I think is interesting in both the books and the television show is the faceless men culture. Like, it's really, really interesting in, like, almost from a religious point of view, from just a badass assassin point of view, from a philosophical point of view, from just some of the rituals and routines. I think it's really interesting, and I think the show is doing a really good job of capturing that kind of sense of... wonder is the wrong word. Like, wonder is kind of like when you see the dinosaurs for the first time on Jurassic Park. If you take wonder and you mix it with a little horror, what do you get? Like, dread? Awe? I don't know. Like, it's almost Lovecraftian. And I think they're doing a really good job of setting, of putting us in that mindset.
I think dread's a pretty good word for it. It's, certainly horrific when she walks in that room for the first time.
But it's an interesting kind of dread.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm enjoying it.
Yeah.
It's also very confusing if they weren't to reveal that this episode. I thought, you know, okay, more of the faceless men playing the face game. Mm-hmm. Why? What does it all mean?
I felt like it hit the right spot between continuing to build its themes and put emphasis on stuff, but also moving to the plot a little forward.
Yeah. If they hadn't moved at all
right.
this episode, I would have been really bummed by that.
Honestly, I thought that, some of the stuff we're going to talk about later on with her trying to play the name game, I thought that was really interesting, too.
Yeah, let's talk about it now, because it's the next scene.
Is it? I thought we got the... Oh, yeah, you're right.
No, Jackie just comes in, wakes her up, and they play the name game, the face game.
The interesting thing about here is the... I thought it was interesting how some of the lies she told, I think, were just the kind of lies you tell when you try to hastily recollect something. You know, it's like, which bandit did... Was it Polliver? Was it this other asshole? But then the one thing about hating the Hound, I mean, that seemed obvious from a show watcher. Like, there's more through their relationship than her hating him.
Yeah.
There's some respect. There's some camaraderie. There's some empathy. It's much more complex than just, I hate the Hound.
It definitely. And I mean, Jackin obviously knows that.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how he knows that.
I don't either.
And that's supposed to be ambiguous, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, this guy knows so much. Maybe he was, maybe he took the face of a mountain or something and went and watched them during their fight and along the road.
Right.
Who knows?
It's kind of like, I don't know whether this is going to be like a Return of the Jedi or a Star Wars situation where you meet the Jedi and it's all kind of like, you don't need to see these droids and lightsabers.
Mm-hmm.
But then you meet Yoda and he's lifting ships out of swamps, and then you get to the prequels and they're doing, pulling Star Destroyers out of orbit and shit like that. I don't know what the limits of these guys' powers are. And also, is it the same as like what Melisandre said last year? She noted that it seems like the Red Priest powers are increasing since the dragons came back. To what extent they're powers are fueled by magic, is it getting stronger, and are they becoming a more powerful faction? I think those are all kind of cool questions to ponder.
Yeah, it's interesting. I guess let's move on to Tyrion.
Also, the statement of "we never stop playing." I think that's another interesting cultural aspect of them too.
Yeah, is he applying that to the faceless men, or is he applying that to the world at large?
Exactly.
To life, you know.
Yes. Yes, all those. I don't know.
Okay.
And, like, is that something where are they ever authentic with each other? Is, like, do you get to the top level of Scientology or OT8, mm-hmm. and there's, like, okay, just kidding about all this stuff. It's really just making money.
Yeah.
Or is it just always, like, is there anyone that knows who Jackin really is in the Faceless Men organization? Is there a leader? Is he the leader?
All good questions.
None of
which we have answers to.
It's all fascinating. Love
mildly,
everything.
Mildly interesting.
This is all insanely mildly interesting. And everything happened in Braavos is really good. Solid gold for me.
Yeah, I agree. All right, we go to Tyrion and Jorah. Tyrion's hungry. He's annoyed with this whole situation. He tells Jorah why he was in Volantis and also that he killed his father. And then he tells Jorah also, your father's dead, because I saw him at the wall, and Jorah didn't know. And he didn't know how it happened either, so.
Yeah. And I thought Ian Glynn's acting was just off the charts on this show.
I'm assuming that's Jorah.
Yeah. Especially when he heard, great. Like, the howl of his father dying.
Yeah.
And it's, like, he's struggling. Like, there's a scene of him, and it's just, like, 5 seconds of him struggling to put this into context, and then you kind of see something click, and he's like, yeah, that's about right.
Yeah, like, maybe he's too honorable of a man for the Night's Watch with all these thieves and murderers and rapists. Like, I felt like there was something going on in his head where it made sense. Okay.
Yeah, and you don't know everything, but it's just a really cool performance because it's like, what is he thinking? Like, what if I had taken the black? And if I... Because that's the thing. Instead of taking his punishment or accepting the black, he chose to go in exile and run from justice.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if that's another facet of his guilt complex.
Maybe he could have been there to help his father if he had...
Or, I mean, one of the reasons his father took the black, I believe, is because Jorah disgraced the family. And he took that as kind of like a substitute, like an honor type of punishment.
Okay.
Or it could have been he'd been there all the time. Either way... if he'd have taken the black, his father wouldn't have to, so he would still be alive. Or if he'd taken the black with his father, maybe he could have been his right-hand man and protected him. But I thought there was a lot going on there.
Yeah, I don't remember enough about Gior's story to really tell you.
But excellent use of Jorah's weather-beaten face.
Sure. And it's not the last time this episode.
Yeah.
There's a sick girl who's brought into the House of Black and White, and her father pleads with her, with Arya to end the girl's suffering. And so Arya lies to her about the healing powers of the well, has her drink from it.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we know what happened. She's washing the girl's corpse.
Yeah.
Jaqen leads her through the door and into this enormous room full of pillars covered in faces.
Yep.
It is a scary room.
It is
the
mini face god.
It is. This was a freaky scene.
Did you think?
Like as she's staring at these faces, I'm going, please don't let that face open its eyes. That's the last fucking thing I want to see tonight.
I kind of, you know, it kind of went down as it does in the book, but there's enough of this show kind of doing some other subtle touches that I was kind of the same place. It's like, I don't know if I can handle it. If this old woman face opens her eyes or does some kind of Pee Wee Herman big adventure, you know, I don't know, but it was really good. You know, I talked about on Instant Cast, how it kind of threw me that Arya coercing this woman, this girl, the sick girl into
she
accepting.
She had a nice face. She wanted it. I mean, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
You got a cute face, girl. I want your face. So
it's a sick face.
Here, drink this water.
It's a sick face.
Well, that all goes away in death. You know?
I don't know if that's true. I don't know if poor Shireen gets her face lifted if the dragon scale comes off. But anyway, but I was thinking about it. You said that she lied. And I wonder if they're trying to make a point that this is like exactly the kind of Obi-Wan Kenobi lying that the faceless men enjoy
They need to hear. Okay.
Yeah, like... What does it mean? Because she didn't say, I drunk from this well and I was healed. Mm-hmm. She said, I drunk of the mini face god's water. And Arya certainly had plenty of experience with death. She's had arguably as much experience with death as anyone. So she's, if you look at death and the mini face god's gift and death all in like a symbolic way, then I don't know that she is lying.
Okay.
Again, you got to do a certain point of view, and you've got a twin sister, and you kissed her last movie, and you kind of fucked up Luke. We're going to pretend. If you take it from that point of view, you know, it's kind of defensible.
Okay. I mean, I think it's defensible either way. You know,
you're right.
This girl is not getting healed, apparently.
Yeah.
Her father's coming to this place as a last resort.
Yeah.
So I don't know that he's looking for a cure necessarily, but just to help her out of her misery.
And it could be that, like, you know, because ultimately the faceless men are religious fanatics, it seems like. So I wonder, you know, if they're all about making sure men get the gift that's coming to them, maybe they don't care about how they take it. Maybe you can tell a few white lies or twist some arms or, I mean, obviously they assassinate people that don't want to die.
Yeah.
So it could be that I've misread their culture.
Okay. We'll see. There's also a line here at the end about her not being ready to become no one, but she is ready to become someone else. Mm-hmm. That made me think that maybe there is another layer to this. Like I talked about in the Instant Cast. I still don't see where that goes though. You know, I can't tell if this other girl who is walking around here is behind or in front of Arya in this progression. Like has this other girl become someone else and then surpass that and become no one and is now just the servant of this cult, I'll call it.
Sure.
Or is she being surpassed by Arya here?
Yeah, and it's interesting because it's hard to say with their not knowing anything about the power structure. I mean, Jaqen H'ghar is what you'd call a field agent, right? He was out there fucking around in Westeros.
Is he no one or is he someone else?
But he's also part of the trainee squad.
Yeah.
Or is that really Jaqen, and it's just a different dude wearing a face that he knows Arya? I mean, like, these questions are all on the table.
Once is that old black man wearing Jaqen's face now?
Yeah.
What is it?
Who is again, that's one of the, I think, core conceits of the Faceless Men. Who are the Faceless Men? Do they even know? Like, is it more of a Borg type deal where it's like, hey,
yeah, become no one in the sense that they're one thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Could be.
Anyway.
Who knows? Anyway, Tyrion and Jorah continue to walk toward the, I guess, just across the country here.
Yeah.
They got a long way to go. Given the map size and where they were right outside of Valyria, they have a lot of walking to do.
Yeah.
Anyway, Tyrion asks why Jorah is taking him to Dany, and he says it's because he saw her walk out of fire with dragons. You know, that'll change you. While they talk about the possible outcome of Dany as queen, they spot a pirate ship and get jumped by them, and they're going to kill Tyrion, and they're going to put Jorah in the salt mines, but Tyrion buys himself some time and convinces them to put Jorah in the fighting pits instead.
Yeah, they're... was a lot going on in this scene. Mm-hmm. I liked, again, enjoying Essirion essentially reciting lines from her last podcast about Daenerys. You know, and it's another thing I really love about Game of Thrones. You know, a lot of works get bleak and you think, man, I don't see how they're going to get a happy ending out of this. Mm-hmm. But I expect a happy ending will come. And there's a lot of works that have shocked me and how bleak they ended up being. And they kind of confounded my expectations, kind of like, you know, Braveheart. Braveheart, you expect his men to come in and save him at the last minute. He doesn't. Ultimately, it serves a greater good. I guess it's a happy ending, but it's like, that's the first kind of like gut punch I experienced as a moviegoer. But Game of Thrones is the first one where I've actually given serious thought well before the book is over about like, this might just be a tale of evil.
Sure.
You know?
Sure. With all of the killings that have gone on for what we view as righteous people, at the very least, George Martin enjoys fucking with us.
Sure.
At the other end of that spectrum, it could literally just be a tale that is very, very dark.
Right. Anyway, all this...
I don't know that that's any less enjoyable, necessarily. You know, it's certainly not the feel-good ending, but I think the journey, if the journey truly is the most enjoyable part or the most meaningful part of something... I think that journey could be amazing.
I agree.
And equally valid. You know?
No, I agree. And also just the novelty of it, this big, vast fantasy world that's ostensibly good versus evil that's subverted.
Okay.
So I think it's super interesting. You don't... Where are you still bothered by the cock merchant?
I'm bothered by the idea that there is a such a thing as a cock merchant.
Would it surprise you that we have considered feedback considering the economics of cock merchants?
No, our audience would not. I would not be surprised by that. Okay. Not at all.
Well, you won't be disappointed.
Perfect. I can't wait to hear about it.
I tell you, from this setup, though, I'm really hoping we see some badass Jorah later on in the season.
So, yeah, I want to talk about Jorah. I would love to see him in the fighting pits. That would be awesome.
Mm-hmm.
The thing, though, that you really notice here in this scene is when he's told that the fighting pits have been reopened.
Yeah.
There's a look on his face that is a look of disillusionment, is what I would call it. Like,
sure.
Really, Dany opened the fighting pits back up?
Yeah. Yeah.
That does not seem like the Dany that he knows.
Yeah.
And you can see that all over his face.
Or it could be also... You know, because the slavers are openly like, well, of course they're doing slavery now because the fighting pits are open. I've never heard of a free man wanting to fight to death.
Uh-huh.
Which is an interesting...
He thinks that she's just made slavery legal again?
Yeah, which is an interesting counterpoint to Dario's like, I would go into fighting pits. I'd fight as a free man. It's sure. like the slaver's perspective on it.
Uh-huh.
But I also thought that there was something in there of Jorah like hatching this plan... Like, this doesn't seem like Daenerys. There must be more to this story. I got to get myself to Slaver's Bay.
Okay. And then he responds finally when Tyrion kind of lays it out there.
Like, if these guys.
The softball.
I mean, what do you think happens? These guys sail into the Port of Marine and they're trying to sell slaves. Do they all get arrested? Did the Unsullied take him into custody? Is there an underground slave ring still running? Like, these are all, again, interesting, mildly interesting questions.
Yeah, no, that's a super interesting question. I think if it depends on who's really controlling the ports and the whole situation in Marine when they finally get there, because they have to sail for a little while. Marine is kind of up in the air at this point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you got the Sons of the Harpies. If they're the ones that kind of control the landscape when they arrive, then I could see it not being a problem.
Right.
if Danny controls it and the Unsullied are the ones controlling the ports and stuff, then yeah, that could totally be a problem. Although I imagine what they would do is they would take the slave, set him free,
yeah,
not knowing that it's Tyrion and Jorah, probably, right. And then they would go about their business.
I wonder if that's what...
Try to get to Danny.
I wonder if that's what Jorah is kind of counting on.
Could be.
That
yeah.
he...
Take me to Marine.
They must be misunderstanding what's going on here, yeah. Well, you're right. Maybe. First step is, like, you know, this is the one time in life it's acceptable to have a step one, get the Marine, step two, question, because the alternative is step two, spend the rest of your life on a gallery until you can't row no more, and you get your throat slit and thrown overboard, so... Yeah.
And they pull your cock off and sell it.
Pull it off? Really? That's...
Sure, why not?
It's not in mint condition. If it's sliced, you have to just pull it right off, huh?
Well, you know, it's up to the buyer.
Like a really. Skin tag. You just
yeah,
grip it and rip it.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Our coverage of Hot D, Fire and Blood, and the 1980s Shogun miniseries continues. But then on Tuesday, for the first time in 35 years, we asked a question. Who framed Roger Rabbit? Hop aboard the train to Toontown as we revisit this incredible blending of live action and animation to see if it still holds up all this time later.
Then on Wednesday, we get our first look at Blake Crouch's mind-bending sci-fi series, Dark Matter. The first two episodes drop simultaneously on Apple TV+, and we'll have a pair of podcasts quantumly linked ready for you to observe.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
All right, Littlefinger arrives in King's Landing, and he's confronted by Lancel, who threatens him, but lets him go because, you know, he's been requested by the queen and all that
really
stuff.
Really impressed with the swag the Littlefinger has here.
Yeah, yeah, given, I mean, he's got to know when Lancel comes up and says, oh, we've basically shut down your whole operation, that he could be in trouble here.
Yeah.
And he's just like, all right, I'm here to see the queen.
Yeah. Well, and like, his smile never wavered. Mm-hmm. He had two dudes... But they weren't armed much better than the Faith Militant.
I don't think they could have taken all those guys.
Like, it's one thing if five Kingsguard go in there and clean house. Like, sure, I think they could take on 30 of those guys. But this was overwhelming odds, and Littlefinger just basically had his swag on, had his YOLO working for him. And
that's Littlefinger, man.
He's climbing that ladder of chaos.
Yep.
Keep climbing, Littlefinger.
I really, really desperately want to see... Someone squash these guys. These
Littlefinger's.
I mean, Littlefinger's guards could squash them. The King's guard could squash them. Whatever. I just want to see these guys squashed.
Braun needs to come back, be reinstated as Lord or Commander of the Gold Cloaks, and just clean house, like all Roadhouse right. style.
I would love that, yeah.
He's the Patrick Swayze. he's the cooler.
I am really curious if Littlefinger can stay out of trouble, though, because so many of his interests in King's Landing have been destroyed. I realize he's got a bigger play going.
Yeah.
But that one's iffy as well.
I spent a lot of time last night thinking about this from like a 360-degree review kind of angle. Like,
okay,
it seems like all of his allies, he's got the Lords of the Vale, he's got the Boltons, and he's got the Lannisters. And they all think that he's loyal, they're loyal to their interests. And I was trying to think that would he survive, like if the Boltons sent ravens to the Lords of the Vale saying, he gave us Lady Sansa to our rapist murderer son, would that affect Lord of the Vale? Or they assume that's a lie? Would the Lords of the Vale listen to Cersei if she sent a raven? Mm-hmm. And vice versa. And I it almost seems like he's engineered this to where none of the sides of the triangle would necessarily believe a message from the other two sides. They all have vested reasons to think that would be a lie, that they were trying to bust up the alliance for no good reason, which is kind of brilliant.
Yeah. I mean, Littlefinger's plans typically are.
Right.
They work for a reason.
I mean, it's the only thing that kind of is like a weakness of that theory is because it seems like I'm, as a show watcher and a book reader, I see Littlefinger as this massive traitor. He is like the Genghis Khan figure that is like, hey, open up your city gates and we'll let you all live. Mm-hmm. JK, LOL, all your dudes over the age of 12 getting your heads cut off.
Yeah.
And I will do that for every city that I come into conquest with. Mm-hmm. And nobody will find out because I've killed them all.
Sure.
But I don't know what his reputation in the realm is. Like,
it's tough to say because
no one knows that he killed Joffrey except for maybe Lady Olenna. And I wonder.
Yeah, potentially.
I wonder if the Tyrells are going to be his undoing here.
Maybe. I mean, they have concerns of their own. They may come to him and say, help us out with this somehow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I don't know, man. I mean, the Tyrells are in a tough spot here, a real tough spot. And I think it's all Cersei's doing. Even more so than the obvious stuff that we've been shown.
The only real weakness Littlefinger's play has had so far is trusting in Sansa not to rat him out at the Vale, but she did. She backed his play, so I just feel like his cover is airtight with everyone.
And trusting her to go along with this marriage, I mean, that...
But I don't think...
Jesus, when he explained that to her, she was like, no, I'm not doing this.
Sure.
This is offensive on every level to me.
On the other hand, I don't know it would have made a difference if she said no.
He would have just taken her to Winterfell anyway.
His best case is she goes along with it willingly for whatever purpose. Mm-hmm. Worst case, she says no, and he's like, well, I was lying about the whole taking it back to the Vale thing. So, you know,
I don't know. I mean, I suppose they could force her to marry Ramsay.
Of course they could.
But not if she's willing to die.
Well, I mean, that's the, you know, you're getting into Princess Bride territory.
I wouldn't know.
I know. God knows I know that you don't know anything about Princess Bride.
Anyway, yeah.
You're the last person alive. I just heard that the last native in the Congo has seen the Princess Bride. You're officially the last person.
Yeah.
1 out of 7 billion. Unique.
I'm a special snowflake. Anyway.
Just like everyone else.
Let's talk about this in more depth in the next scene. Because Littlefinger and Cersei are talking about this situation at King's Landing. And she basically asks him, will the Vale fight for me if, you know, Stannis comes down here? If the Boltons give me a problem? And he says, yeah, I've got... Well, kind of. He says, I have control over Robin.
Mm-hmm.
Which is not exactly a yes, we will fight for you sort of thing.
Sure.
It's a, he will do what I tell him to do.
Yeah.
Who knows what he's going to tell Robin to do, but it might not help Cersei. Littlefinger then tells her that Sansa's alive in Winterfell, and Cersei wants her head and says, let's go get it. He promises to if she waits for Roose and Stannis to do their thing up there and then mops up. and which makes him Warden of the North.
Solid strategy.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then, you know, if he comes in,
anybody who's played a game of Risk can tell you that that's how it goes, right?
Yeah.
You wait for two forces to clash, and you go in and mop up.
You turtle up in Australia.
You do, yeah.
You wait till the two superpowers duke it out, and then
but not too long. Because if anybody takes North America,
it's
you're
all
screwed
over.
Over
right.
Yeah.
But you just bide your time, you save your reinforcement cards, and then you bust out.
You do.
Bust out through New Zealand, and it's all over.
Yeah. Land war in Asia.
It's always
to make a Princess Bride reference.
Going to drop a Princess Bride reference now. Asshole.
How do you feel about Littlefinger potentially taking Ned's position? Is that offensive? Is that super offensive to you?
Man, so
Ned was such an honorable guy.
That's the thing. Like, I was a Stark loyalist from season one before I'd read the books, and it continually takes my breath away how much fuckery the Starks have to endure at every level.
Yeah,
it just keeps on getting their teeth kicked in. It's so if I'm being honest, I'd rather Littlefinger sit on the Lord's seat in Winterfell than goddamn Roose Bolton.
Sure.
Or fucking Ramsay Snow
Bolton. Ramsay Bolton, man.
Yeah. Well, I call him Snow.
He hyphenated it. Snow Bolton.
Snow Bolton. Bolton Snow. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess, like, you know, it's a classic lesser of two evils, lesser of two assholes.
Okay.
But I don't know.
Yeah. He's just such a plotting, I don't know, Weasley character that I don't feel right with him taking Ned's position. But,
I mean, that's a new, you know. But this is a new plot point. The fact that, you know, so Stannis thinks he can take Winterfell because he's got the advantage, but it does sound like it's a near thing. Mm-hmm. Littlefinger riding into the Knights in the Vale, which he tellingly says have been trained to fight in the ice and the snow, is a big game changer. Like, I don't see how he stopped. Whether Sansa lives, dies, or whatever, he's in a position to spin that in to his maximum advantage. Now, it seems like once he does that, unless Sansa dies in the attempt, and he does just put her head on a spike, I don't know how he keeps his alliance with the Lannisters. But at that point, you know, we talked about it. If you own the Vale, if you own the East, mm-hmm. and you own the North, and he's got Harrenhal too, which is one of the richest holdings of the West, like, other than Castle Rock and Highgarden and Sunspear and King's Landing, which is, you know, I think he's in game over territory at that point.
It's super interesting the way that he's come to this position in a very roundabout way, you know, and that's Littlefinger for you.
Yes.
He maneuvers all the pieces into his favor without people really even noticing.
I don't even know. We had a good email that I don't want to step on the toes too much, but I think it's even when he talked about climbing the ladder of chaos, I don't think he plans in the way that we've attributed these plans to him. I think he does things that destabilize the people in power, and that he relies on his own quick thinking and connections to step over another rung. Like, I don't think he intended to, you know, have Ned Stark come to King's Landing, find out the Lannisters were a bunch of incest babies, and then get his head cut off.
No, I mean, obviously he has, you know, his birds out there or whatever, listening. And
well, that's Varys.
That's Varys. Yeah. But, you know, he's connected to the information pipelines.
He's got his whores.
Yeah. His sure. But, okay, I buy that in that he kind of wings it from plot to plot, but he does plot too. I mean, he definitely arranges pieces on the board. He knows what he's doing at certain times. It's not like he's just going, oh, I found Sansa Stark, I'll, I don't know, travel to the Vale. I think he's got an obvious plan when he's doing these things, like taking Sansa to Winterfell. There's a plan there, right?
Yeah, but taking her to the Vale was a gamble. Like, there was no way for him to predict that.
He does gamble, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean,
he said that himself, of course.
So he wanted to take her to the Vale to see what would happen. I mean, that's the biggest and most obvious risk I can think he took in the series. Like, trying to, you know, pass her off as his illegitimate daughter. When that ruse fell through, then I don't know. But I'm trying to figure out why he killed
Joffrey.
I'm not sure I agree with you that he has a organized plan. I think it's more that he just, like, pours gasoline on fires and then has a monopoly on fire extinguishers or whatever. Like, you know. As long as I wonder if he'll also...
So does that implies that he doesn't have a goal either?
I think he has a goal, but I also think that if once he starts getting to higher and higher in the rungs of power, if he'll start to be a little bit more cautious. Because when you're down, when you're just the, you know, one of the lesser lords of a lesser holding, every move you make, like win, lose, or draw, you're going to have good odds in moving up.
Yeah.
But once you have half of Westeros, don't you have to start being careful? Can you still
unless,
make those big all chips?
He,
the more chips you got, the harder it is to push them all in. I wonder if that'll be eventually some kind of weakness that's exploited.
Yeah, but you can also use all those chips to bully people, you know? Yeah. Push them in, scare people. You know, power kind of begets more power in some ways too.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I just like how he's kind of backdooring into the most powerful person in Westeros.
Yeah.
Militarily at least. I think that's very interesting when you contrast it with people who have a rightful quote unquote claim to the throne. Like Dany. Dany, you know, is kind of looking at this traditionally. I'm going to walk into King's Landing. I'm going to kick down the door and I'm going to be the queen.
It makes you wonder.
Same with Stannis. I'm going to kick down the door. Yeah. I'm going to be the king.
It makes you wonder. Like after this week's episode, I don't think it's possible that Stannis wins. I kind of was entertaining that idea that maybe he would be able to unite the North. But with this, unless Littlefinger doesn't follow through with his threat, it seems like whatever force survives at Winterfell is going to be crushed by Littlefinger's forces. And it makes me wonder.
But what does Jon Snow is going to play a part in this. Jon Snow going north with Tormund, bringing troops down, 60,000 or so.
True, yeah.
Is what he said.
Yeah.
That's a huge number, and I don't know that Littlefinger knows about that stuff.
That's the thing. And what does Littlefinger think about Dany? And like if and when she comes to Westeros, that's what I've been thinking.
It doesn't feel like he's thinking about Dany at all.
Yeah, like whoever comes out of the east, they land on Westeros, what does the game board look like at the time?
Yeah.
And
it's
going
to be different than they expect, I think.
Yeah.
I think they expect the Lannisters to be in complete control.
Well, I think last season.
And if you can defeat King's Landing, you defeat Westeros.
Sure.
I don't know that that's going to be true.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think last season, even the latest books, you kind of assume that it's going to be, oh boy, the Lannisters are going to get theirs. But man, they might be has-beens by the time that all happens.
That would almost be unfortunate. Like,
I
kind of want them to get a righteous ass-kicking.
Right.
But yeah, it might just trickle away from them.
And hell, Dany might not even get out of the east.
True. Yeah.
She's
having plenty of problems.
She is having a Vietnam, Afghanistan, whatever situation over there.
I just wonder if Littlefinger is actually going to be able to mop up if Jon Snow shows up. Like Jon Snow could be his undoing, honestly.
And Jon Snow would be loyal to Stannis, you think?
Probably.
Like he goes in there and there's a three man fight. You know, who does he, it's a WWE, who does he take the folded metal chair to?
Probably Roose.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think he's tagging in and he's going to pile drive him.
Right. But I don't, that's like, again, it's like who in the Seven Kingdoms knows that Littlefinger is a shit? Because if Littlefinger's flying, if he's coming in under the band of the banner of I'm going to liberate Winterfell for Sansa or try to save Sansa. You know, does that confuse? Because we know Stannis is, that was his intention. I'm going to go and I'm going to liberate your father's house and return it to the north.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't know. That's a good point.
It's going to be super interesting.
I
can't wait for
that
battle.
I've been saying that, like, Winterfell is just shaping up to be a clusterfuck.
Yeah, I love
and
it.
And late in-season game is going to be really intense over there.
Yep.
Or up there, I should say.
All right, we've got Marcella being charmed by the Martell boy, whose name I don't know.
Tristain? Yes.
Tristain. And the prince is watching him.
They are a cute couple.
Yeah, yeah. You know, they're cute kids in love. That's a fun time.
I'm glad she put away the bubblegum princess outfit and went with the yellow.
Yeah, it's better. Although I think she might be wearing it underneath that.
Oh, really?
I don't know. She's got some strappy pink thing underneath it, so not sure. Anyway, he tells guards.
Curious that she's not wearing Lannister red. Do you think that's an intentional thing that they are? You know, I'm always
disguise her.
Yeah, no, well, I'm always looking for ways to see like what are they trying to tell us behind the scenes? And it's like, do you think that Dorne is doing an intentional kind of re-education campaign on her, like trying to get her to forget her Lannister roots? And you're going to be wearing, you know, Dorne yellow or Martell yellow.
I mean, we've see later on that you know she's kind of. Buying into this whole
pink is a,
Dorne thing.
It's gone. Pink is a watered down version of red. Now they got her in yellow.
Yep.
It's just it's a psychological game, man.
Could be. So the prince tells his guards he's going to need his axe because This is a dangerous combo. This Martell Lannister combo.
Yeah, it's people incredibly are gonna be after dangerous. Her. People can be after them. Really shouldn't let them in this massive garden completely unguarded.
Uh-huh. So Bronn and Jaime are riding through the countryside. Bronn is singing. What song is he singing? The third song of Westeros?
Yes, we've got a new song. The Dornishman's Wife has made its appearance.
All right, perfect.
The Baron and Maiden Fair, the Dornishman's Wife, and the Reigns of Castamere.
Yep. So they spot their destination, and they blend in with a group of people to get inside the gates.
And which, if you're keeping score, that's essentially two songs about men or animals leching on women, and another song about Tywin Lannister masturbating all over the corpses of his foes. So awesome. that's the pop hits of Westeros.
top 40 is the top three, because there are only three. At the same time, the Sand Snakes also set off to capture Marcella. Not a ton of talk about it. I thought it was funny seeing these guys going through the countryside. Jamie's obviously so annoyed with Bronn by this point that he can barely stand it.
I'm sure Bronn's plenty annoyed at Jamie too.
Nah, Bronn's the one doing the annoying here.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Jamie's annoyance is more of an existential, you're trying to get us killed.
Okay, yeah.
And this is poor planning, and I'm dubious about why I'm even here in the first place. Bronn's annoyance is much more petty.
All right, so Jaime finds Marcella, and he tries to convince her to leave, but she doesn't want to go. And the Sand Snakes show up, and they fight over Marcella until they're all captured by the prince's forces. And then we see Ilaria is also captured.
This is the stupidest scene I've ever seen in Game of Thrones.
Oh, my God. Okay, why?
So you're going to do a daring raid on the princess. Would be presumably heavily guarded, which she's not. But you choose to do this in broad daylight. Mm-hmm. And two rival factions that have no ties to each other whatsoever are going to converge on the same spot within a 30-second space.
Okay.
And two of the daughters...
I don't have a problem with that, just for the record.
Okay, well, fine. Fine. We have three daughters of Oberyn, presumably well-trained in arts of war. They've got a whip, they've got a spear, they got double daggers. They're fought to a standstill by Bronn, which, fair enough, and Jaime. They're like 1.3... dudes cannot be outfought by these three supposedly badass sand snakes.
One of them has a whip, which is entirely useless. Well, as a maiming weapon,
it shouldn't be. Indiana Jones does okay with his.
Oh, come on. Like, Indiana Jones, you can't kill somebody with a whip. It's not gonna happen. You can disarm somebody, but you can't.
They don't have revolvers in Westeros, Jim. You can't do the classic just whatever, shrug and shoot the guy.
They have spears. They should just be like, you get over there, I'll get over here, we'll surround Bronn, 1, 2, 3, stab.
All right, so if you want to make the argument that the fight is stupid from its construction and characters, I'll go with that too, because I kind of agree.
All right, I think the whip is just useless.
But, so, I think the setup and the premise is dumb. The way they went about it was incredibly lazy. Like, I can't believe this made it out of the writer's room. And then the actual choreography was cover your eyes bad. Like, they pulled all the tricks of the trade, the quick jumps and the quick cuts. So, like, the actors only had to memorize one sword twirl or one step, and they couldn't capitalize on that. Like, you think of what they did with last season's...
The Oberyn fight with the mountain.
The Oberyn fight was spectacular. Yeah. What they did at the wall in episode 9, which I believe is Michelle McLaren, and she's one of the best at directing action. But this was just really terrible.
I'm with you. On second watch, this choreography is really bad.
Like, just watch what Bronn's doing in the background of a fight that the camera's not.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's the worst. And the twin dagger girl, which I think is Nymeria, she's just terrible. She's a terrible actor. She's terrible at the spear work. Obara's spear technique is awful compared to Oberyn's.
So that's another thing I don't like about it is Obara's supposed to be the baddest of the three, right?
Yes, you would think.
And they have her fighting Jaime, who's supposed to be basically useless, and Jaime holds his own. I don't like that.
No, it's terrible.
Like, unless you're trying to say that these sand snakes are not nearly as skilled as we think they are, then you've filmed that scene completely incorrectly.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Its analog in the book is lamentable as well.
Okay.
So I don't know. I mean, that's one of the reasons I'm not super outraged by it, but It's interesting
I bet it was affected by them not having enough time.
The best part of Dorne is Prince Doran. And I think they got a really good Alexander Siddig. Dr. Bashir I think, a great actor. And he's done really well in the 30 seconds of screen time. He's got it.
Yeah.
Why the hell they are focusing on the Sand Snakes and just Jaime invasion and all this crap at the expense of making him look stupid? Because, again, he just made a statement. This is a dangerous situation. I'm making damn sure my household guard knows that they need to be keeping a close eye. And the fact that this fight raged in the water gardens at all is borderline preposterous.
Well, here's the thing. The timing doesn't line up exactly as they show it. Because you can see Myrcella and what's his stupid name?
Tristane
walking out of the garden.
Uh-huh.
You can see Doran and his guy looking down on them and watching them walk out of the garden. And moments later, when they're kissing, Jaime and Bronn roll up. But between that, we have Jaime and Bronn getting to the city.
Yeah.
Like, just spotting the city from the outside. So you know there's, like, there can't be more than a couple of minutes between the time when
they
watch them go out of the garden and they're kissing.
You're misunderstanding my point. My point was, three episodes ago, we had this fight between Alara and Prince Doran, where she's like, "You're a coward, blah, blah, blah. We need to go to war." And he's like, "Tough titties." And she stormed off. He should have known that there was a threat, potential threat to the princess from that point forward. I mean, the capital city had just killed his brother that went there to get justice for his daughter or his sister.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got the princess of the Baratheons there as kind of like a hostage slash marriage alliance. It just makes him look foolish that there wasn't more guard going on there. And I'll just put it this way. In the books, he's a lot more on the ball about quashing all this bullshit before it even happens.
I wonder why they didn't go there.
Because they didn't get to do an exciting fight scene, except for the fight scene is bullshit. I mean, it seems like a lot of times this show likes to inject some action where maybe there's not as much action. But yeah, I don't know.
Sure.
It just didn't work. It didn't work on any level for me.
All right. Well, the one part here that I don't have a problem with is the coincidence of timing that they show up nearly at the same time. Like, I don't know if that is, it's apparently not one of your big gripes, but it's
certainly a big gripe. I would bitch and moan about it if it's the only thing wrong, because that's kind of what I do. That's my personal.
But I don't know why. Like, I don't know how you can defend the Battle of Blackwater when you say that coincidence is always a problem.
Why? What do you mean is a coincidence?
Because Tywin just shows up.
But that was,
saves their asses.
That was set in motion. It was like,
this is all set in motion. We know where these two forces are going, that they're going to the exact same place.
But King's Landing was ready for them. Like, it wasn't like a sense of, like, out of nowhere, these two invading forces converge and King's Landing's a shock. And what do we do? I mean, this is something they were gearing up for weeks and weeks and weeks.
Same here. They traveled across a fucking ocean to get here. We saw scenes where the Sand Snakes were preparing to go get Myrcella. Like,
and broad daylight. Set up. Didn't have a.
Nope.
In broad
Nobody
daylight.
Was guarding her. Why well, not?
That's why I'm saying, so there you go. There you go.
I'm just saying the coincidence is not the part that I have a problem with.
Yeah.
But you're right. It's not
before
a good
we,
scene.
Before we move on, Bronn got cut conspicuously by Obara's spear.
Yes, I want to talk about this.
So talk about
Come on, poison, right? Poison. Look at the mountain.
Well, I think there's someone on the forum said it best. On the one hand, you know, Oberyn went to the Citadel to train as a master or a maester for years to get the expertise in poisons that he was well-renowned for.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, and his daughters probably did not. On the other hand, I can't remember who said it, but it's hard to believe that Oberyn would teach the technique and not the sneak.
Yeah, I mean,
so it's like, you don't need to go to college for 3 years to know how to mix some plant poisons together and kill a dude. Yeah, I fear for Bronn's life.
Me too. And that's going to leave Jaime in a really bad situation too. Not being able to fight, being stuck here.
Although if Obara is Dorne's best fighter now that Oberyn's dead, I don't know. Maybe he can fight his way out of Dorne with his left hand.
Maybe
I don't know.
Maybe
I don't
know. All right, let's move on. Elena shows up and talks with Marjorie about how ridiculous this stuff with Loras is.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Why did her wagon stop on the road?
Just randomly? I have no idea.
It's like,
it's got to be important though, right?
Yeah, it's like she's got regularly scheduled quip stops.
What are these fools waiting for? Oh, that's right. It's 408.
The lady must sass. It has been yon 5 miles since her last sass. Halt! Halt, we say. And then she does her quip and then moves on.
Yep.
That's the beginning of some really weird editing choices.
It's super weird.
Because if you look at the sequence, like, Olenna's, Marjorie's not in that wagon with her. Mm-hmm. Then she is walking King's Landing, and her voiceover continues and bleeds into the scene of her sitting there with Cersei talking. Mm-hmm. It's like Peter Jackson pulled this kind of shit in Lord of the Rings a lot, but it kind of worked. Where it'd have someone zoom in on a face talking about something that's applicable to a situation that's like halfway across the world.
Yeah, they do that a lot.
And it kind of ties the narrative together, but there's something that just didn't work. And I was like, where the hell are we? Who is in the room? What's going on? And I'm not sure. Okay. This could also be symptoms of them having some compressed filming, and they just didn't get the shots they needed. And, you know, I don't know. Like, the shot of Lady Olenna making a shit joke about King's Landing was so good they had to shoot that in there.
Yeah, I don't know why they included that.
We wouldn't get the fact that she would have to come back from the Highgarden to King's Landing unless they had it. It's bizarre.
That's the thing. So we get an answer to our question whether Margaery has left or Margaery has called her grandmother there.
Yeah.
Obviously, she's come to King's Landing.
Right.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
So she talks with Cersei and she demands Loras be released, while also threatening, you know, we're not going to give you any money or food anymore if you don't solve this. And Cersei's just denying it the whole time. Had nothing to do with it. It's a Faith Militant. Talk to them.
Ineffectually, because that's her poker face leaves much to be desired.
No, it's the thinnest of cloaks here. I mean,
and what's funny
or as Elena says, what veil? What veil? Yes. There is no veil on either side of this table.
No, she's like, veiled threats. Like, what? You guys, you do need... This isn't...
I am threatening you, not threatening a threat.
It's like watching a six-year-old try to lie to your face. Like, the fact that
you've been caught and you're just going to continue to insist that you had nothing to do with
it. And they never conceived that they would get caught. So they're completely flat-footed and just gasping like a fish flopping on a dock the whole time.
But here's the thing. I think Cersei knew she would get caught. I think Cersei knew that everyone would know this was her doing, and this is her plan. Literally just deny it and defy everyone because she thinks she can get away with it. Okay. I don't think she has, like, some grand plan that, like, she's going to win the Martells back on... Or, I'm sorry, the Tyrells back on her side. I think she's just going to fly in their face and say, fuck it.
That just makes her seem... I mean, and it's good to be intentional. So stupid, because...
Yeah,
Tywin Lannister said last season, we are flat
fucking broke.
Uh-huh.
We have pulled no gold out of our famous Casterly mines in...
Oh, but don't worry. The governor of Naboo is going to come back with all the money you can possibly want from the Iron Bank, right?
Not if they've got his son and daughter in prison.
Exactly, yeah.
No, it's... I just liked Lady Olenna's performance because, like, the whole... At the end, she's looking at her like, God damn it, I'm too old for this shit, but I guess I'm going to have to break you.
Yeah.
It's going to be so much work, and I'd rather be home sassing my servants, but I guess if you're going to make me... Like, I don't even want to go to war with the Lannisters. I really don't, but I can crush you like a bug.
Sure.
Or I can just pull my support out and watch your kingdom devour you. I mean, that's another possibility.
Yeah. I wonder how aware Cersei is of how precarious her position is. Like, does she understand that she actually does need these people quite desperately? I know Tywin understood that. I don't know if she does.
Yeah. I don't know, because I've got a definite opinion, but a lot of my opinion is probably colored by the book, so...
Okay.
I'm mildly interested in see how they... Because one thing I will say is that the show Cersei is a much more, you know, just like show Marjorie, is a much more three-dimensional, well-realized character. They've actually thrown in some things that make her seem sympathetic and cunning in a fashion, so I'm kind of curious to see where that goes. What's the end game with a slightly... more believable three-dimensional Cersei?
Well, I do give her some credit. I think she is kind of cunning. She understood what was going on with her brother and the whore and how to use that to get what she wanted, to get revenge on Tyrion.
The thing about her and even in her show scheming is she never considers the other person. It's like when you start playing chess, And you start thinking about, like, your moves in advance.
Yeah.
But then the next level to get the Grandmaster is then anticipating your opponents.
Sure.
She plans her moves as if the other person is just not going to move their pieces on the board.
Right.
And that's why I think she ends up with things like her father being murdered.
Uh-huh.
And her brother escaping from prison and things that she doesn't conceive of. Because she's like, I'm going to do things and these people have nothing that they can do back to me.
Yeah, and she's also vengeful and petty, and she has a lot of bad qualities that lead her in directions that
shouldn't go. It's like Tyrion says, she's got good cheekbones and she loves her children. That's her two good qualities.
The extent of it, yeah. Yep. All right, so during the inquest here, as she calls it, Loras and Margaery both deny Loras has done anything wrong. Unfortunately, they bring out this guy from Littlefinger's brothel, who was also Loras' former lover. As we know, I forget his name.
Oliver. Or maybe it's Olivar, but whatever.
Olivar.
Ollie.
I don't think you can get away with that in this show. Who claims that he slept with Loras and Margaery knew about it, and he could back it up with knowledge of the birthmark.
This horse shit.
Is this too much of a out of nowhere for you?
I mean, they laid it all out, but if I was the defense attorney, I'd be objecting all over the place. It's like, he's his page. That's essentially a valet or valet.
Sure. I don't think the argument was convincing.
Do I think most pages see their knights naked when they're responsible for dressing and armoring them? Yes, I do.
Almost certainly.
Yes, yeah. I do. I bet there's more than a fair share of buggery going around, which is, you know, there's been a lot of like background chatter about how kind of homophobic Westeros is, because I think in the books it's not that way. It's not really nearly, and also Loras is much more of a cartoonish gay man.
He's sure it's still seen as a sin, you know, according to the laws of the seven gods or whatever.
Sure, and these guys are religious fanatics and all that, but I just think that the evidence is thin, and it's all, I don't know. And it's a kangaroo court, so it's like you can only apply so much legal reasoning. But even if they took Loras because he had direct eyewitness testimony, what proof did they have that Margaery? I mean, this guy, he's got proof that he knows about this Dorne-shaped freckle on the young gentleman's thigh. What proof does he have that he was in that Margaery was in the bedroom?
Nothing. And I mean, that's just one of the clues that this is part of Cersei's obvious plan. I mean, what reason do they have to scoop the queen up in this as well?
Is Littlefinger
behind? What possible reason?
Let me ask you this. Where did they find Olivar? And how did they know that he had this relationship with Morris? Well, they found him.
They took him from the brothel when the other High Septim was taken out, didn't they?
No, I mean, that's the thing. We've always wondered when he's going to be arrested. But I'm just like, how did they make this connection that Oliver was sleeping with Loras? Because to my knowledge, only Marjorie knew that. I don't think Cersei knew that. Littlefinger would know because he's Littlefinger's employee. I wonder if we're supposed to understand that Littlefinger is kind of helping grease these wheels. Because we know Cersei's a lot more complicit in this than she's claiming to Lady Olenna.
So would Littlefinger view this as actually working against Cersei, even though he's giving her what she thinks she wants? Because, I mean, this is going to cause a rift between the Tyrells and her.
Well, I mean, the question, obviously, he's not loyal to Cersei. So, yeah. But this could be an easy... It's cost him nothing. It further destabilizes the Lannisters because it takes the Tyrells away potentially as an ally.
Yeah.
Which is something that, like, Cersei does not worry about at all. Like, she says...
No, she's foolish.
She says the Lannisters have no rival. That's not what your dad thought.
Yeah.
You know, one of the smartest, most capable Machiavellian rulers in Westeros. I don't know. It is enjoyable to see Cersei kind of weaving this web of deceit and lies and trickery and seeing if she can get herself out of it.
The other wild card here, I feel, is Tommen. Like, with Margaery being taken away and put on trial, I don't know that Tommen, as the king, is going to stand for that.
Yeah, and we know that Cersei has no real power.
Sure, yeah.
Her power is only what she can get Tommen to go along with, it seems.
And she doesn't seem to give him any kind of credit for really having any involvement in this.
Well, that would be her. I mean, again,
that could be her undoing.
Her not considering the opponents have moves.
Exactly. With as much as we've seen of Tommen and Margaery and her effect on Tommen, I think he might step in and do something, which would be awesome with a King's Guard versus Faith Militant showdown. Yeah. I would love to see that.
No, but this scene was infuriating, not because it was bad television, just because Cersei's smug face combined.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And then, like, again, the King's Guard. Like, I feel like the king would have to make them stand down before they would let the queen be drug away in chains by a bunch of dudes with shitty wrenches and robes. You know? That's a direct insult to their royal highness. Like, you know, they're the Secret Service. If Barack and Michelle Obama is sitting there and some dude tries to drag Michelle, it's like, well, unless the president tells me to go after the First Lady, I'm just going to sit there and chill. I don't.
But I mean, according to, you know, what's gone on here, Tommen has appointed these people as an authority.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's. That is a kind of condonement of.
I mean, I get that the Joffrey and Tommen era Kingsguard is not exactly cut from the cloth of the Age of Heroes and everything, but come on. And then the final scene of Lady Lyanna's face, she's gone from annoyed that she's going to have to expend the effort to break Cersei to just fucking pissed. And I'm excited.
I don't know. I'm not sure I totally agree when it's the king's decree that the Faith Militant have rule of the land here.
They don't have absolute rule.
No, but they've been appointed as law.
They're snatching the queen, man.
I know, but the king himself appointed them.
So if they try to snatch the king?
And is condoning everything that they do, apparently.
So if they try to snatch the king, if the king just sits there as a mumbly-mouthed 15-year-old, they're going to let it
probably
happen?
Probably. Yeah.
Oh, fuck.
Yeah. King's appointed guys, man.
I'm going to agree to disagree.
All right.
I want to see some goddamn Kingsguard going bananas.
I do too. Trust me. Anyway, at Winterfell, Miranda comes to bathe Sansa, and during the bath, she tries to get in Sansa's head by questioning whether she can keep Ramsay happy and telling stories of people who haven't. And Sansa says, you know what? You can't frighten me. Get out of here. You better worry about the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Is there an... I talked about an instant cast about the hair washing symmetries here. Yeah. It is telling that Arya was washing a corpse. Is this the beginning of foreshadowing that Sansa is going to die? That she is not, like, not only is she not going to be the strong character to save herself, that she's ultimately going to be destroyed by this Winterfell clusterfuck.
Could be. I mean, I speculated, you know, the third option in this is that Sansa's killed up at Winterfell.
Yeah. And I'm like, you know, I was to this point in this, the episode, I was really excited because, you know, she dismissed Miranda. It's like, I can finish dressing myself. I was like, oh, yeah, Spike Theory back on. It's going to have that thing hidden on a person.
Nope, doesn't happen.
Yeah.
Theon comes to her room, is ready to escort her to the wedding, and she just doesn't want to touch him. Nope, not going to touch you. She goes to the wedding without touching him.
What do you think? And I feel like an asshole for pointing this out in the context of her later being raped, but I just want to point out I have a long history on Bald Move Podcast of critiquing wedding dresses.
Okay.
Sansa's wedding dress, the worst.
Yeah. It's a Stark wedding dress through and through.
That's some Bjork right? type shit that she's dressed. I mean.
Okay. I suppose so. Yeah. She's from what? Iceland. It's pretty cold. Pretty cold.
Oh yeah. Okay.
Pretty
yeah.
cold up there.
She's essentially from the land beyond the wall. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's getting cold up there. They make a point of saying that. They make a point of it snowing. Winter is coming.
I wonder if it kind of gave me a Catherine the Great type of vibe. Like, I wonder if it was supposed to be like kind of bulky armor, you know, layers of armor kind of in a form of a dress, if we were supposed to get that symbolism from it.
I wasn't getting the armor stuff, but I don't know.
It's like a tank of a wedding dress.
It is. Well, it's like a wolf pelt. I mean, it's this giant wolf pelt? The shoulders are very like big furry things. I don't know what animal it is.
I was getting swan, like two giant swan asses on her shoulders.
Yeah, she went from being a raven to a swan.
Something.
Whatever she was in the Vale. Anyway, Sansa is then wed to Ramsay Bolton in what I felt was a fairly drawn out wedding scene.
I thought it was.
If you're not going to stop and say no, then just say yes. Come on.
Well, there's drama, but I thought the Godswood set was on point. And as I was watching the second time, I was thinking.
You can definitely tell it's a set, though.
Really?
That is a fucking set in a soundstage. Like, there is no way that is a real location.
Anyway, I thought it was interesting that you think about Sansa and what a girly girl she was. If she hadn't had this exact fantasy about getting married in her father's Godswood and
to a different person.
Well, no, the same thing is like, say what you will about the Boltons. That was a really lovely setup as you can do in the Godswoods, and they had candles and it was very kind of romantic and it was even snowing and it made what's to come even worse. But I think, you know, it's another one of the things where it's like, this is a situation she might have dreamed of, getting married to one of the High Lords of the North with her father watching, and it's been perverted into this goddamn nightmare.
Yep. That is unfortunate. I'm sorry, Sansa.
Yeah, it's terrible. What do you think, also in this scene, what do you think about making Reek play Theon so much?
I love it. I think it might be a mistake. On Ramsay's part, but I love it.
That's what I was getting at.
From a drama perspective.
You've broken this man's psyche and had him take on this other identity, and you're so confident in that you're forcing him to take his old identity to the point that like his voice hitches when he tries, you know, it's like very tough for him. It seems like that might be reconnecting neural pathways you might not want to connect.
Yeah, no, I totally agree, and I think he may have some problems in the future. And that's why I call him Theon in this scene, because he clearly is. He's washed up. He's in nice clothing. He's got his hair slicked back. Like, that's Theon Greyjoy right there.
Yeah.
Just a damaged version of him.
Sure. I also
And it's really hard for Theon to even say his own name.
Right.
And like when he's, you know, giving her away or whatever. And that he was Ned's ward. Like, he feels that sense of, I just betrayed everything that I cared about.
Yeah. One thing I think that they were trying to do, you mentioned the long drawn out acceptance of, you do accept this man, is I think that the filmmakers, and I don't think it was entirely successful, but I think they were trying to suggest that Sansa did in fact have a choice here. You know, it's a choice bad choice with shittier options. But it's kind of like the choice of storming the beach of Normandy or cowering in the back while the machine guns slam your boat. Like,
sure.
I don't think it necessarily worked, but to this point, it was going along with Littlefinger's. Well, you've got to fight. You've got to do some unpleasant things to strike back against your family's foes kind of wisdom.
Yeah. No, I'm with you. I understand what they were doing there.
Yeah.
And it was fine. I just thought it was a little drawn out.
Right. And that kind of hinges on me thinking that if she just refused him outright, that would be a big deal.
Oh, I mean, I think so.
It could turn into a giant, like...
How angry would he get? He would get super angry.
Well, and also, like, I think the Lords of the North were supposed to understand that, like, a lot of the Bannermen and stuff are there to witness it. Uh-huh. And you'd think that that would be significant, but...
Yeah, you know, it's essentially the Starks condoning Roose Bolton and his actions. You know, that's what this is about.
And I would like to have seen, I wish they had gotten like the great John Umber or some of the other recognizable Northern Bannermen from season one and season two to be in the background, kind of looking like they're not sure about this. Uh-huh. I thought that was a missed opportunity too.
Okay. Then we get the final scene. Ramsay takes Sansa to his chambers to consummate the marriage against her will, pretty much. Forces Reek to watch.
Yeah.
Bad news. Bad news all around. It's not surprising, though, that Ramsay returns to form immediately after they're married.
How fucking pissed is Roose going to be when he finds out?
I don't know.
Like the heart really of Northern power, and he's got Ned Stark's little girl screaming in the bedroom. It's just not...
Yeah, I'm
I mean,
I'm
I guess this
sure.
isn't obvious, but that's not a good look from a North Remember standpoint. North doesn't need.
I agree with
North
that.
North doesn't need a string around its pinky to remind it. But if they did, they just got it.
Yeah, probably right.
This also kind of is what I was saying about the goddamn tower and the highest, the candle in the tallest tower. That's not a really great thing for Sansa to take advantage of.
Just calling in Brienne?
No, I'm saying like it's ineffective. Like that, it did her no good to have that release valve in this situation.
Yeah. I don't know. I definitely think there will be consequences for this. I'm curious what they will be. Probably all out revolt, but we'll see.
Yeah,
we'll see.
So what did you think of this scene in context of Sansa's broader character arc? Because my position is, you know, Theon got tortured for a whole season, and it was, you know, tough to watch. Even though he was kind of an evil character, and he brought along a lot of that on himself, but also Theon was a cocky, arrogant, high on the horse character that was being brought down notches.
Yeah.
Sansa's living in the basement. She has been since the middle of season one.
Yeah.
Why? How is this necessary? Like, I think that part of the problem, part of the negative reaction people have had is that raping a female character is such a cliche. Like, you know, that's the if you want to give a strong female character a revenge motivation, then you rape her. Mm-hmm. That's kind of like a lazy thread-worn plot device.
Okay.
And also it's extraordinary if you think about all the POV characters in this show, how many have either been raped or nearly raped. Like even Brienne, Cersei. The only one I can think of is maybe Arya. Although I think maybe she almost. Like some of the ruffians that her and the Hound confronted were threatening that, and then like Marjorie, I think that's one of the reasons that people were upset. But the main reason is, what in the hell are we supposed to be teaching? Like, what? Why does Sansa have to go through this to then presumably have a stronger character turn? Like, what more motivation does she need?
I'm going to agree with you that, yes, it is cliched, but in so much that it works, right? Like, that gets it through character and audience's heads that now is the time for revenge. And so if this truly is a turning point for her...
Both parents being murdered, her brother being murdered, her being pawned off the two different shitty marriages.
Well, she was completely useless at that point, right? She's a little girl. She doesn't know what's going on.
Uh-huh.
She has literally no power at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Now she might feel like she's starting to come into her own. I mean, we've seen her travel with Littlefinger. Littlefinger has taught her a thing or two.
Yeah.
Now when she has a reason for revenge, she might actually be able to act on it.
Yeah, I mean, I mean,
there has been a character arc, but I don't know.
I feel like it's been flatlined in the valley for so long. And
it has.
I eventually came around on Theon because, you know, you have if you kind of have to really be explicit to show how deeply this man's been broken.
Yeah.
Because not in the books where he's a POV character, you can kind of get inside his mind of madness. And the book is actually less graphic than the show in a lot of ways, because it was a lot of alluded to backstory rather than, you know, explicitly shown. But I think you needed that to explain why Theon would go from the Theon we knew to the man who cringed and hid in a dog cage rather than take the freedom that was offered to him.
You do. Completely agree.
Whereas Sans, like I said, I just feel like she's been kicked in the teeth so many times. We could have skipped there, but I feel like that the showrunners wanted to do this particular remix, and they had this particular group of characters and this particular group of characters, and it would not make sense for like Ramsay to be suddenly like have a romantic turn or something like that. Like, it makes sense for Ramsay to brutalize her. It's just, I just wish they had a way to construct this to, you know, something different would happen.
I didn't realize that it was a remix, because I was thinking, well, this could just be George R. R. Martin fucking with the audience.
Well, I'm saying there's like, when like, I say remix, I'm using it.
This girl's going to have some kind of great blossoming into what you want her to be, but she's not.
That's
like,
what I'm
saying.
That could
be Martin just doing that.
None of the stuff of Sansa has ever happened, or even like hinting that it's going to be happened in the books. So, but I'm saying it's a remix of characters and locations and events. Yeah. It's just a really curious combination of those things, and an unfortunate one in my mind. Because, you know, just like I think there's a contingent of people that get a little tired of Dany being mired over in Essos, there is a contingent of fans that think that this is just piling on. Like, at some point, like,
it
max
is, but
out
so
on
is Robb
scale.
Stark's death, like Catelyn's death. I mean, those are pylons, right?
No, that was ending their character arc. Like, if they're going to kill,
yeah,
like if they kill Sansa next episode, this really does seem just pointless cruelty.
I don't know that that's out of place in this universe, though, given the history of it.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, we're talking about how, oh, this might just be a tale of darkness and the ending might not be happy at all. Well, that follows right along with that.
I don't know. I mean, there is a school of thought that I'm sympathetic to that, like, you don't, I mean, it, there's some things that are very sensitive subjects to viewership, and you shouldn't play with those unless you've got a good reason for it. And I don't know that this show has a good reason to go there with Sansa in the spot that she's already in. You know, and there's positive ways to have this debate, and there's negative ways to have this debate.
So could this be a way, like, let's say next episode Sansa says, fuck this, I've had enough. She Popeyes up and does something ridiculous that totally defeats Littlefinger's plan for whatever was going to go on here. Is that enough to sway you? Like, this is the kick she needed to break Littlefinger's hold on her?
I'd have to see why it couldn't have happened an episode sooner. That's the whole point. Okay. Like, why did she have to be brutalized one final time before she had her you know, turn towards being a heroic character? That's the whole crux of it. Now, another complaint that people had is the way this was framed, like the, you know, Sansa's entire rape sequence was played out on Theon's face.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of people upset with, well, you know, it's one thing to rape Sansa. It's another thing to have this be about, you know, the rape of Sansa is more about Theon's character arc than it is about Sansa.
Okay, but that is Ramsay through and through.
No. I'm talking about Theon's face. Like, again, this, it's almost like as the camera thinks that this is a bigger, this is a more impact on the man watching it than it is on the woman it's happening to.
I didn't get that from it.
I don't think that's intentional. I mean, I can see why people do. I don't think it's, I think it was more of they were trying to be as tasteful as they can in filming this. And instead of the camera lingering on what's going on with Sophie Turner, to try to be more respectful of that situation, they go to Theon.
Sure.
But I can see why a lot of people would be offended by that they chose to see the scene through the lens of a man's eyes rather than a woman's.
I think they're misreading that scene.
What am I saying is there's a lot of potential insults that these filmmakers are piling up in the one scene. There's a lot of potential minefields with, and also they don't have the greatest reputation in this area as well.
Sure, no.
I feel like the Double D's definitely have a few blind spots when it comes to producing some of this stuff.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Anyway.
That's it for the episode.
That's it for the episode.
Yeah.
Before we get to feedback, just want to give a shout out to this week's sponsor, which is once again Audible. You can get a free trial of their service by going to audiblepodcast.com/GOT, courtesy of a Bald Move. You can get a starter account with a free audio credit for a free audio book. And as I'm wont to do, I'm going to play a little clip from Dance with Dragons, narrated by the great Roy Dotrice, about Arya's first encounter with the Room of Faces in the very deepest parts of the Temple of the Faceless Men, the Many-Faced Gods. So without further ado, we will play that clip.
The kindly man lifted his lantern and flicked its shutter wide open. Light washed over the walls around them. A thousand faces were gazing down on her. They hung upon the walls, before her and behind her, high and low, everywhere she looked, everywhere she turned. She saw old faces and young faces, pale faces and dark faces, smooth faces and wrinkled faces, freckled faces and scarred faces, handsome faces and homely faces, men and women, boys and girls, even babes, smiling faces, frowning faces, faces full of greed and rage and lust, bald faces and faces bristling with hair. Masks, she told herself, it's only masks. But even as she thought the thought, she knew it wasn't so. They were skins.
So if you enjoyed that and you want to know more, you want to take in more of these vistas, you want to get the primary enjoyment of myself as a book reader, of seeing these things and anticipating how they're going to look like on the big screen and seeing them for the most part like come really true. I thought this was a great version of the Room of Faces. In fact, it outdid the one in my head. You can get caught up and join us in the spoiler speculation. You can start forming your tinfoil theories of your own. Audible is a great service to use to do that. And it's not just Game of Thrones, although they have the entire works of George R. R. Martin in unabridged format. They have 185,000 other spoken word titles ready for your perusal. Again, tell them, Jim, how they can get their free trial.
Just go to audiblepodcast.com/GOT and just sign up for a free trial account. And you get a free book.
There you go.
Let's get into some feedback.
Peter R. said, as a show watcher, not a book reader, I wanted to mention a possible plot point that seems obvious to me but has not appeared yet. In a world with so many evil characters, why aren't people using the stone men or grayscale creatures as chemical weapons of sorts? One would think that some evil ruler would be catching these folks to use them against the
enemy.
How
do you catch one?
You know.
Without becoming a grayscale.
Nets and poles and, you know.
So that's dangerous business, man.
Of course it is. It's as dangerous as like catching a tiger for a...
It's more dangerous because a tiger can't... A tiger is not going to turn you into a weapon against your own people.
Right. Okay. So it's approximately as dangerous as rounding up zombies in The Walking Dead. Yes. And that is used many times throughout the series as a weapon. So I think it's a kind of interesting concept. You round up a bunch of crazy stone men. You drop them in the middle of, you back up at the cart, the wagon, and you dump them off into a city center, and then you go off. Like, it seems like more of a terror weapon than a practical weapon of war, but there again, that's a lot of chemical, biological weapons in a nutshell. They're more terror weapons than actually strategically useful.
Yeah, I get the feeling, I'm getting the vibe from this show that grayscale is a thing that they don't know how to contain. Like, they capture these things, these beasts, these grayscale stone men, and they throw them into Volantis.
Mm-hmm.
Valyria, to get rid of them, mm-hmm. to keep them away, because they don't know how to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
it's almost like too dangerous.
Like, playing with fire.
Yeah.
It's just wildfire. A bad idea.
Moving on to William C. said, we are recently reminded of Brienne's hatred for Stannis and her vow to kill him if given the chance. I think the show is setting her up to be between two conflicting desires, her vow to kill Stannis and take revenge and her vow to Catelyn to protect her daughters. At some point, Brienne's going to have to choose between these two conflicting views. Mm-hmm. She'll have a chance to kill Stannis or help Sansa and will have to make a choice.
Dark Knight.
What do you think? Yeah. What do you think? Do you think she's going to find a way to Batman out of it, or is that going to be a genuine moment of drama?
I can see that being a moment of drama. Yeah. When you have...
What do you think Brienne does?
I think she honors her vow to Catelyn.
Me too. Yeah. And to the fact, it's like almost not dramatic to me because, yes, I'd be genuine.
Like, that's the obvious choice.
It'd be a genuine surprise, but it also seemed to be a betrayal of everything they set up about her character, which I don't, maybe that, I mean, would be.
If you don't kill Stannis, so if you don't kill Stannis,
yeah,
he lives and you can kill him later.
Right.
If you let Sansa die.
Yeah, you
she's
can't,
dead and you've broken your vow.
You can't undie her.
Exactly.
Well, find okay. the right red priest.
Uh-huh. She's going to come back a little worse for wear, but, sure. you know.
Maybe she'll maybe one of the pieces she loses is her wedding night. That's not necessarily a bad,
sure.
bad thing.
I agree.
Amir B said, I've always wondered why the wildlings would get ships from Stannis and then use them to sail south through the wall. Why wouldn't they take those same ships and just fuck off to east and Essos instead? The advantages are, one, they don't need to make peace with the Black Brothers. Two, they don't have to kneel to some king. And three, it's a different continent from the White Walkers.
Yeah, no winter.
Once they're leaving their homes, why protect themselves with an ice wall when they could protect themselves by a huge sea? My only thought is that maybe they don't know why the Essos exists. Jim, I've never really given this much thought.
I've never even thought of it.
I mean, that's, you've got the Dothraki that won't cross the poison sea, as mm-hmm. they call it, because, you know, they're superstitious and horses won't drink salt water and they're horse people. So there you go. Mm. Do you think that there's some kind of either cultural ignorance? Like, they don't know that Essos lives over there? We never hear of wildling raidings, and the narrow sea is, after all, the narrow sea.
Yeah, it seems like maybe they just didn't, they never had the ships to do it.
Or could be the dislike, you know, people are stubborn about leaving their homes. You hear all the time about, like, volcanoes. Like, a volcano is going to destroy your home, old man. And it's like, yeah, I've lived here for 50 years.
Yeah.
Like, that'll protect you from...
Mother Nature.
Yeah.
No, I don't know why they wouldn't have ships of their own.
Well, I understand why they have...
There, right? I mean, closer toward the wall, I guess. But, yeah, yeah. You go further north and it's just ice.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I feel like that they're mostly...
Maybe they couldn't. Yeah. Maybe they literally needed to get past the wall in order to build ships. And
but they have what he's saying there. Is Stannis gave them ships.
Yeah, oh, I know. Now
they're going
up
now to pick their people. Yeah. Why don't they sail east? My own explanation
John
is...
John Snow won't let them. I don't know.
Well, there's that. He's the hostage and warden.
Yeah, so commander and hostage.
I don't know. I think the most plausible situation is that they just don't know that Essos exists.
Could be.
Joe Y, listening to last week and this week's podcast, a question about good versus evil, the nature of things inside Gurm's world has got me thinking. We can all agree that his efforts to pick Game of Thrones have been brutal and blunt, to say the least. Let's look at what has shown us as a quick glance. He's taken over 24 prominent characters in the back of, from the start of the books and distributed among them into three categories. One, killed or had their loved ones killed. Two, just generally worse off. And three, better off.
Okay.
So on the list of loved ones lost or killed themselves, you got Ned, Catelyn, Sansa, Arya, Rob, Jon, Bran, Daenerys, Tyrion, Renly, Oberyn, Brienne, Drogo, Mance, Hound, Robert Baratheon, Jorah, Lysa, Joffrey, Cersei, Jaime, and Tywin. Alive, but
Jorah.
Yeah, his dad died.
Oh, Gior.
No, Jorah, the son, his father got killed.
Wait, this category includes both of those.
Yeah, it's
the people
you are either killed or you've lost a
I would put them in
blood
worse
relation.
Off.
Okay, well,
okay, sure.
All right, well, the worse off category, which you would put Jorah, to be clear,
yep.
Is Sansa, which she also lost someone she loved. Maybe I'm misinterpreting this slightly.
Yeah, I don't know how you put them in separate categories.
Arya, Jon, Bran, Tyrion, Daenerys, Brienne, Varys, Cersei, Jaime, better off, Bronn, Littlefinger, Ramsay. In list.
That's sad.
He says, so in the better off category, we have a professional murderer, a liar, and a psychopathic lying murderer. Mm-hmm. Does this subtly tell us that it pays to be evil and that evil wins out? Or is that too much to assume since we are not yet at the end of things to see what the final tallies are?
Yes, I do agree with that last statement. Wait to the end to find out. But so far, you're absolutely right.
Would any ending be capable of justifying all the atrocities that have fallen upon the good people of Westeros? Do hundreds of good people dying or having their lives destroyed become acceptable if one good person triumphs an end and takes the throne?
Potentially, yeah.
See,
like if I saw Jon Snow on the throne, I might say it was worth it.
What I'm hoping for, and this is my pet theory, is that no one is going to sit on the Iron Throne. That
can be dismantled.
That this whole Daenerys experiment with kind of like parliamentary democracy over in Essos is going to be a cultural revolution that sweeps the globe, and that we're left with the Dream of String being kind of like the start of Western style democracy instead of these dictatorships that can be benevolent or malevolent, but the common people have no say in it. That's kind of where I don't think it's as interesting to say who's going to sit on the whatever throne you've got. I think it's more interesting is like what kind of societal sea change. That's what can justify lots and lots of suffering. Like
benevolent dictator could also.
Yeah, right? But he dies and he has a crazy son, or he gets deposed. Like, that's not a permanent solution.
It's not permanent, no.
So I think a systemic change is what I'm hoping for. But that's me. Jeff R. says, anyway, did you notice anything strange about the old man Brienne talked to when looking towards Winterfell? Specifically, this is the last episode, the North Remembers guy. Specifically, that dumb floppy hat he was wearing. The only family I've ever seen wear those were the Freys. Could this be Brienne being in trouble and not even knowing it, much like she wondered aloud about Sansa? Or is it just a coincidence and those terrible, terrible hats are actually a style in Westeros?
I think that might be a northern hat.
He's right, though. Like, do you remember that scene where we first met Walder Frey, where he's like sitting there and like all of his sons are on these benches like a damn packed jury box, and they're all wearing that stupid hat?
No.
And every time we see the Freys, they're all wearing that stupid hat.
I don't remember the stupid hat. No.
Well, the North remembers those stupid hats, and they're a sign of the
obviously,
Frey.
Obviously, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know, because that's a show motif. It could be a northern custom, but I thought it was interesting. Okay. Not mildly interesting, because I have no knowledge one way or another.
Next week, we're going to see Littlefinger in the stupid floppy hat. I'm the Warden of the North, time to don the hat.
It's the latest fads from Winterfell, my lady. That'd be like taking the latest fads from Mooresville, Indiana, taking them to New York.
Great.
They did that with trucker hats, though, so stranger things have happened.
Sure.
Moving on, Dion B. said, first we had Tyrion and Varys' roadshow called Bald and Chain. That show got canceled, and the character of Varys recast with Jorah, the suggested titled Full Head of Bear. Dion thinks the obvious title for season 2 of the Jorah and Tyrion roadshow should be BJ's and the Bear.
Okay.
No sale on Jim Jones. I thought it was funny.
No, I like Full Head of Bear. Yeah, I like it.
Moving on, Brad T. had a question about the economies and capabilities to various places in the Game of Thrones world. What would be the GDP of all of Westeros south of the Wall compared to Essos or Dany's Slaver Bay Empire? Obviously listing a number of gold
compared
dragons.
Compared to Essos?
Yes.
Like zero?
What do you
mean? The Iron Bank is in Essos, right?
Yes, you're right.
So fuck the rest of
it. Okay, so this is what I'm wanting. This is what I'm wanting from a show perspective. Right. Obviously, listing a number of gold dragons would ever be useless. So if you had Westeros GDP is 100, all of Essos would be what in relation to that? Marine would be what? Braavos would be what? What's your estimation? You think Essos is way, way richer than Westeros?
I think the concentration of all wealth in, what do they call this whole land, this whole map, this whole world?
Planetos?
Is that what they call it?
That's kind of what the fans call it. I don't think they have a name for it.
I think the concentration of all wealth on the known planet is in the Iron Bank.
Yeah.
And that's how they portray it, certainly.
It's a really hard answer. I did some research into it, and Forbes had an article where they tried to quantify the Lannister wealth in proportion to the Tyrell's wealth and the North and all that thing. And all that stuff, but I suspect you're right. Like,
I know the rest of Essos is super poor.
Yeah.
Well, that's not even necessarily true.
No,
the ten free
cities are really rich, like all in their different ways.
Yeah, I think Essos has a huge, massive wealth. Yeah. Now, I don't know that they have like all the same resources, like physical goods.
That's what
Westeros does. Yeah, that's true.
Like, they got the whole Greek city-state thing where they're always warring between each other and fighting and squabbling. Of course, Westeros kind of has that, too. You got to wonder how much of their potential GDP is just destroyed in military fuck-ups.
Yeah, probably.
But I guess it's like I see Westeros as being like the UK.
Okay.
And all of Essos as being kind of like the rest of the European Union. Hmm. And I can't, you know, like there might be some poorer, some richer, but overall they're just much bigger and has a much larger economy. But I don't know. It's okay. It's very hard to find that kind of real world answers other than the Lannisters got lots of gold. The Iron Bank has tons of money. Yeah. Other than those big, and the Martells have lots of land and lots of wheat. Beyond those generalizations, and the North is poor. They always make it a point about how poor the North is.
Sure.
Anyway, moving on to Andrew M. I'm going back a bit, but I feel like this plot has been abandoned. In season 3, episode 8, Stannis throws out Melisandre's leeches containing Gendry's blood into a fire and calls out three usurpers, Robb Stark, Balon Greyjoy, and Joffrey Baratheon. Two of the three usurpers meet bitter ends, Robb and Joff. When is Balon going to get his comeuppance, and what the fuck is Gendry up to?
Who the fuck is Balon?
Balon is the father of Theon. He's the head of the Iron Islanders, the pirate kingdom. Oh,
Jesus. We haven't seen him in
ages.
I mean, we haven't seen him since he sent Theon away, have we?
Right. Well, I think we saw the last time we
maybe
saw him is when
his
he opened,
daughter talking to
when
him?
He opened up the box that had Theon's cock in it.
Okay.
But right. That was at the end of season 3.
It's been a while. I don't know, man. Like I'm wondering. I kind of felt like those storylines were over once Theon's sister came in to try to liberate him and found him in such a sorry state.
Yeah.
Now, I suppose they could bring it back if Theon ever becomes Theon again.
Do you think that they intended that to go somewhere and it just didn't? Or because it is seeming like a little bit of a plot hole.
A little bit, yeah. Maybe they're buying their time.
Licking their
biting their time until they can respring that on us.
Balin's desperately trying to father another son. It's like, God damn it, I thought I was done with this.
Yep.
Bring me a winch.
Once he gets his son back too, he's gonna be cockless. So
I need my salt. Yeah, right.
Useless from a legacy standpoint.
I need another salt wife.
Yeah.
What the fuck is Gendry up to? Last seen rowing.
Gendry was
rowing a boat from Dragon Island to Westeros, I believe. Gendry is the bastard son. He was the blacksmith that kind of palled around with Arya, the bastard son of Robert Baratheon. Melisandre seduced him and sucked some blood from his breeches with their leeches.
Yeah. You said he was going where? I don't remember where he was going.
Davos freed him because Melisandre wanted to burn him at the stake or something. Yeah, yeah. And he put him in a rowboat and said, row that way. That's the last we saw him.
Well, who knows? I mean, he gets caught in a current. He
he's
might
still
end up
rowing.
In marine.
So, yeah, he's whereabouts unknown. And it's to be determined whether that's significant or not.
Yeah, it seems like they like to do that in this show.
Yeah.
And in the books. You
like,
know,
stock away some
forget
characters.
Forget about these characters.
Put them in the fridge.
They're inconsequential. And then later on, they become a huge part of the plot. Like, look at... I mean, right now, Loras and Lancel are both blast from the past who...
Especially Lancel.
Especially Lancel, but I mean, even kind of Loras. He's always been in the background just as like a pawn.
Yeah.
Now it's really coming to the forefront.
Kate B., when watching this episode, the part about the dwarf cock being a luxury good reminded me of the Vice on HBO episode about the rhino hoarding trade.
Oh, yeah.
If you use Earth in the 1400s as a proxy from Planetos, you can come up with the following math. Total population, approximately 375 million people. Persons with dwarfism as a percentage of the population is about 0.004%.
Oof.
So we had 15,000 dwarfs on Planetos. Natural sex ratio is 51.69% in favor of the male. For a grand total of 7,753 dwarf cocks available for potential sale.
That's a fair amount.
Now, other than the Unsullied and Theon, I don't know who is in a market for a cock, but clearly this needs to be sold as a luxury good and thus the need for cock merchants.
Yeah, it's like, you know, spice merchants, right? Like
spice merchants.
You get a really expensive spice that's tough to deliver.
It's luxury
and
good.
There you go. Yeah.
Fine you gotta dwarf market. Cocks. Yeah, and you got to have them be, it's got to be, they got to be authentic. Can't be passing off baby cocks.
And they're right. I mean, like, how do you tell it's a dwarf cock if it's a normal-sized cock?
How indeed?
You got to cut it right off the dwarf in front of them.
How
get
indeed?
A little tag of authenticity.
Yeah.
Where the dwarf himself signs it. I don't know.
Casey J. has additional thoughts. There could be absolutely a cock merchant in Essos. Even if dwarf cock is a very rare item, I think they could be sold like people currently sell exotic animal parts in some parts of the world. Wanting a dwarf cock is no more ricoculous than wanting an elephant tusk, a rhino horn, a bear pancreas, or perhaps a relevantly tigerish cock. I don't think a cock merchant would be traveling profession, though. This seems like something that would need to be sold in a secure office. I think the idea of a cock merchant is way more likely than King's Landing Delta Force and San Fox Force 5 both making their moves at the same time. Another not big fan of the synchronicity of the...
People may have misunderstood me. I don't have a problem with the idea of a cock merchant. It's a very funny concept. I just have... It is a ridiculous concept at the same time. That's why I think it's funny.
A recoculous concept.
Recoculous, yep.
Aaron McPhee said, I'm becoming increasingly convinced that Cersei's making a big mistake working with the High Sparrow. She's pissed off the Tyrells, but even worse, she's giving them the means to get revenge. After all the Queen of Thorns has to do is tell the High Sparrow that King Tommen is a product of incest and not the true king, and they'll be turned against Cersei.
What proof does she have?
Good question. Of course, she still has to get Margaery and Loras out of prison, and there is a Kingsguard to worry about. Perhaps Lady Olenna can use that threat to compel Cersei to cooperate. That's the thing. What is the proof?
Their blonde hair? I mean, Cersei's got blonde hair.
My Littlefinger...
Robert Baratheon could have...
Ned went to Littlefinger with his accusations. So Littlefinger knows.
Okay.
If
they're working together as we have speculated.
Also, Ned sent out ravens. Or maybe, no, it was just a Stannis, wasn't it? And then Stannis sent out ravens. So that's kind of hearsay. Yeah, it's the proof. It's the because they kept it very on the down low.
There's no birthmark that is like, oh, on his inner thigh is a birthmark that says product of Jaime and Cersei.
Right.
Like,
right. They autographed it.
Yeah.
It's a J&C production. All right. Moving on. Josh M. said, when Jaqen was invited Arya to Braavos in season 2, he said, a girl has many names on her lips, names to offer up to the Red God. She could offer them all, one by one. He led her to believe that if she trained as a faceless man, she could use her skills to carry out her vendetta. Now that she's actually there, he says he must leave her old life behind and abandon everything made her Arya Stark. Well, that death list is a big part of what made her Arya Stark. It looks to me like a classic bait and switch. Recruited her under false pretenses. Jaqen lost a few points with me. Total dick move.
It's part of being faceless. He was just playing the face game with her.
He was. She didn't know.
Can you detect my lie? No.
Yeah, she didn't know.
We need to train you.
Yeah. Like, I wonder. That's a pretty funny concept. Like, if that just continues. Like, when will you learn? Will you learn?
Flies to her at every turn.
Marlene from Portland said, regarding of whether Jorah had contaminated Tyrion with grayscale, my thought is that the contagion would probably be spread by touching infected skin, or in Shireen's case, an object had been in contact with infected skin. Since the stone men's bodies are entirely covered with the disease, any touch from them would be instantly transmitted. Jorah's infection, however, is still contained in one small covered patch on his arm, so even though he touched Tyrion with his hands, I think it's unlikely that Tyrion will contract the disease from contact.
Reasonable? Yeah, I mean, that seems reasonable to me. I really hope he's right. I don't want Tyrion to have grayscale.
All right. Roger R. said, after hearing your instant take and Aeron talking about how he's tired of Sansa being a victim and asking when she's going to get a chance to stand up for herself, well, I don't think we'll get that chance. As a show watcher, I've dealt with many a book reader just smiling at me when events such as the Red Wedding and the killing of Ned and saying, it's just Game of Thrones, man. Now we're out of book reader knowledge, and on some storylines, I'm hearing from book readers that they... about why they think Sansa should fight back. Who says that's ever going to happen? Sansa's been traumatized by what happened to her, and to her knowledge, her entire family has been killed. Pair that with Ramsay's torture techniques. She soon might be yet another person under Ramsay's direct control. We have been fooled time and time again that something good is going to happen to the characters we like, because we've been programmed by 95% of entertainment that stories have happy endings. Well, Game of Thrones is pitched to me by saying that doesn't play by the normal rules. Mm-hmm. I don't think the Sansa story will end with her getting revenge against the Boltons, and if it does, it will come at such cost that it wasn't worth it. And when it happens, I will just smile and say, that's Game of Thrones. That is a valid take.
It's Game of Thrones, man. I mean, that's essentially, you know, what I was saying before about this kind of happening.
And especially over and over. From a show watcher, it must be, you know, pure schadenfreude to sit and see a book reader like, I can't believe this has happened, because that's been their world for 5 seasons. And now I can see why turnabout would be fair play on there. And there might be some of that element, like book readers have been flexed this whole time. Like, you know, they're not letting their guard down about Ned and Rob and all those things. But when a haymaker flies out of nowhere, it stings.
What if that is actually George Martin's intention by not writing these next books?
You think to protect that integrity much of the television show?
No, no, no. To fuck with the book readers who have been for so long fucking with the show watchers.
Oh.
You think he's that diabolical?
He's pretty diabolical.
I mean, he's the guy who wrote the character of Littlefinger. Yeah. Come on.
It's kind of funny. He wrote a whole big, long blog post this week about explaining. Like, he did this last year, too, after the Cersei rape scene, where he's like, look, the show's different from the books. I think
disavowing the show.
No, but he also says, I think the Double D's are doing as best they can at adapting this work, and it's drifting ever further apart. And he has confidence that they'll eventually come to the same conclusion. But yeah, he's basically stop bitching at me about what's going on in the shows and how it's different from the books.
Yeah.
Get off my lawn.
I think that's fair, though.
I'm trying to write a book. I agree too. Especially when we're talking about the subject of rape, it does seem like there's a lot of rape in the Song of Ice and Fire.
Okay.
But arguably there's even more in the television show, and that's kind of weird. Jamie T, longtime listener.
Mm-hmm.
Disclaimer, I'm on Team Sansa, and I read the Sansa scenes last night, totally different from you guys. She hasn't reverted to a weakling. In my opinion, she's taken Littlefinger's very good advice about laying low until she's coaxed all of them into a stupor, thinking she's a subservient weakling upon which she will slaughter them all. Their guard is now up. So when she was squeaky at the wedding and so forth, I was like, good girl, you look terrified. And of course she is terrified, but she's also pissed off, and suppressing that anger takes strength. If I'm correct, many men under Bolton's command would rather rally to the Stark's call, but that would be messy and slow. She can take them all out clean. The rape scene was hard to watch, but I think it's important for two reasons. One, the zoom up on Theon's face shows that they're building to a revenge plot. Theon doesn't have the willpower like Sansa does, but this is getting him there. And two, it shows how strong Sansa has become. She's playing the long game in the face of great personal pain. Killing the Boltons is a noble thing in this fictional world. It's bigger than her own comfort. In the first season, Ned Stark was always trying to get her to see the big picture, but she only saw her own comfort, her own small wants. She's come a very long way. Do you agree with Jamie's take here, or do you disagree with her take?
I don't think I'm prepared to disagree with it. I think I see a lot of the, you know, influence of Littlefinger in the person that Sansa's become of late. Ever since Joffrey was killed, she's been traveling with him and getting a glimpse into kind of the heart of darkness with Littlefinger, figuring people out, figuring things out, learning to manipulate. Now, I took that earlier in the direction of like maybe this rape scene is the point where she says, you know what, I've had too much and I can't play along with this anymore. But I suppose it could also be what Jamie's saying it is, which is, you know, her being strong in a sort of strange way.
Mm-hmm.
Just the perseverance that she would have through all of this in order to exact revenge in the way that she wants it. I mean, I could see that, I suppose.
Yeah, there's little parallels of the Magi that got burnt at the end of Dany, is that, you know, her thing was Dany, quote unquote, rescued her from a rape gang, but she didn't make that distinction. So she gained her trust and confidence and then fucked her over. And later on, she got fucked over in return. But yeah, I mean, I could see that. And again, I mean, future events can certainly change my mind about this thing. It's just hard for me to see now where Sansa getting one more black eye before she becomes the strong person was necessary to see.
Are we considering next time on stuff spoilers?
We usually do, yeah.
Okay, because I saw a scene which explains a little bit about what's going to happen with this particular
scenario.
Well, you
keep your spoiler whore mouth shut, man.
It was right after Game of Thrones. I don't know how you missed it if you're not trying to.
Well, if you're watching on HBO Go or HBO Now, you have to actually do several clicks to get to that.
No. It continues to play.
Really? Because Go does not.
Behind the scenes, Now does.
Huh.
I don't know. Huh. I don't have Go anymore. So
that's interesting.
But yeah, now it just goes right into like the behind the scenes stuff, the interviews, and like they show a little bit of next time on.
Well, see, I used to watch it always on Go, and on the PlayStation 3 viewer, you had to select it as a different menu option.
Yeah.
PlayStation 4, unbelievably, still does not have HBO Go. It's been almost 2 years since it's been released. So
what?
I'm back to fucking recording Game of Thrones on my DVR like a fucking farmer.
Wow.
It's ridiculous.
Wow.
Andrew, the Commissioner Mount. Says, I think it's tricky to say that this makes her character weak and a victim and that she has no agency. I don't think that a woman, or in this case a young girl, being sexually assaulted makes her weak. I don't think she's weak if she doesn't find a way to fight off and kill her attacker. In fact, I think there's been a larger machination by Littlefinger or an intervention. I'm sorry. In fact, I think had there been some larger machination by Littlefinger or an intervention by Theon to save her, it might have robbed her character of some great moments further down the road. Sansa seemed weak and victimized in the past, not because bad things happened to her, but because of how passive she was forced to be afterward. In a weird way, her passivity has been her armor, too, but we haven't seen how this event will shape Sansa's character yet. Bad things happen to people in Westeros, whether they are strong people or not. Sansa's had just another Ned gets his head cut off moment, and we're going to have to wait and see if her reaction shows her agency and strength of character, or if she shrinks back and is swept along like she was in King's Landing.
See, I guess I'm leaning more towards your side of this, where she has been so stagnant for so long, because like you said earlier, she has had a lot of impetus to be angry and strike out before. I still stand by what I said. She was a very different person then, and she didn't really know how to go about that.
Yeah.
But I think what Jamie and Andrew, this is Andrew's email, right?
Yep.
Are not considering is what you said, which is it has just been so long where this girl has been shit on over and over and over again. Why would this necessarily change the equation?
Well, it's kind of like, so we criticize Walking Dead a lot because Rick gets in this thing where I got to be the leader. I don't want to be the leader. I need to be the leader. I don't want to be the lead. It's like just back and forth, flip-flopping, tread. Like nothing really changes significantly in his character. And we're, you know, it's one of the things we debate is like, is this going to be the turning point where he finally decides to do whatever? And we had that same debate about Tyrese.
We had the same debate about Don Draper.
Yeah. You know? And like that is, it becomes, it's some of that stuff can become really tiresome. And then you add something explosive like rape to it, then people get really fucking cranky about it. So like, I understand all the reactions and I'm weary of it too, in the same way I was weary that, you know, Danny was shouting and screaming for dragons all in season one or season two. So,
I think a lot of how you view Sansa depends on your perspective, you know, in your own life.
Sure.
Like that's what a lot of cinema and television, a lot of good stuff does.
Yeah.
You bring kind of your own baggage to it and you judge these characters based on that. And I think that's fair. Like whatever opinion you have on it, I think is fair until the story unfolds, you know, like whatever speculation you want to do is fine. Mm-hmm. Once the story unfolds, we can see whether or not we like it.
Sure. Usanu A wrote in, my prediction for this episode is that Littlefinger was not in fact dumb enough to leave Sansa by herself. I do believe he's installed a spy network of some sort in Winterfell to spy on the Boltons for him, as well as to watch over Sansa. I think that the same network is leading or responsible for whatever mysterious underground group in the North that keeps saying the North remembers. This includes the granny who told Sansa to light the candle of the Broken Tower if she ever needs help.
All right.
That would be interesting that we've actually, by debating whether Littlefinger is dumb enough about if actually he's another step or two ahead of us and he has got this thing wired for sound and light. That would be kind of cool.
It would be.
Would it be too unbelievable? Would you? Okay.
No, I'm on board with the Littlefinger as the
ultra capable.
Master.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, the grand chess master.
Like Varys and Littlefinger, and to some extent Tywin, I would almost believe anything.
Yeah.
They're like Joker from the Dark Knight levels of diabolical planner.
Uh-huh.
Heath L. from St. Louis. All right, I lied. The game extends beyond Bond villains. Oh, he's giving us an update about the Bond casting. Okay. It extends beyond Bond villains to overall 007 characters. I completely forgot about this until the Queen of Thorns came back on screen in this week's episode. Lady Olenna Tyrell is, of course, played by Diana Rigg, who is the one and only wife of James Bond himself, Contessa Teresa di Vincenzo. In the movie On Her Majesty's Secret Service, George Lazenby's one and only effort at being James Bond, aka the one that no one's seen, Agent
Deep 007, cut. Yeah.
Yeah. Agent 007 truly falls in love and ends up marrying this woman, even though she's originally hated Bond and she eventually fell for him, which makes the ending of the movie all the more depressing. When just after wedding, literally as they're driving away in the car, Tracy Bond is killed after being shot in the head in a drive-by shooting. Spoiler alert from a 1969 movie.
Jesus.
Very Game of Thrones, too.
Yeah.
Ties it in there.
Nah, I've never seen that one.
We're all bonded up in this piece. Where's Pierce? When we're going to see Pierce Bronson?
Pierce Brosnan's going to show up as in the fighting pits.
Can we cast Sean Connery as the Northern Lord?
Probably. Yeah, why not?
He's
like 80 now, but.
Sure. Well, I mean, there's lots of. The old bear was not that spring chicken either.
No, Walter Frey's looking pretty frayed. Oof.
Yeah.
So, yeah, why not?
Lee VDB. The name that just endlessly rhymes. When will it take, or what will it take for Theon to snap out of it and pull and not put his own safety above the suffering he sees? I know he's broken, but when will he actually break? Good question. Is he actually going to?
I think he will.
Is he going to snap?
I've thought since the beginning of time that he's going to. Yeah. I think it'll be soon. I think it'll be soon. I think this might have done it, actually.
Yeah.
This might have done it for both him and Sansa.
Okay. It's interesting to give him. So that would be, I guess, a redemption arc for him. But yep. He needed a redemption arc because he fell from grace. Like, you've seen heels turn to face and face turn to heel, but this would be a face heel face turn.
Yeah.
Really, really odd. I don't know if I'm aware of anything like that in fiction before. Mm-hmm. Joe H. says, Jorah now knows Daddy Jorah is dead at the hands of the Night's Watch. When Jorah is given the sword Longclaw back to Jor, and Jor in turn gave the Longclaw sword to Jon, when Jorah sees Jon with Longclaw, I imagine will assume Jon took the sword after leading the revolt against Jor.
Oh, no.
Either way, Jorah's disdain for the Night's Watch will surely put him square in opposition to Jon Snow, don't you think?
And then he'll have to fight Jorah, one of the fiercest fighters in the land.
That is an interesting thing. Should they ever meet? Yeah, like he found out that his father was killed in a mutiny
by his own men. Yeah.
And the Lord Commander now is swinging Longclaw around. That will be a that's bear baiting. Is what you call that?
That's gonna be bad news for John. I have a feeling.
Rai writes in and says, I was just feverishly doing research on WebMD to figure out this whole grayscale business. Unfortunately, no info whatsoever for some reason.
Surprising.
I don't get it. Does grayscale do something to your brain, aka the rage virus from 28 days later? Do the exiled grayscalers go mad over time from being exiled?
Seems like
it. Do the banished become nihilist? Why would they go attacking a couple of wary boaters that float through Valyria? Second of all, Jorah has grayscale. That slaver guy is wailing him in the face. Does that guy now have grayscale? If you have a bad case of grayscale, are you then more contagious? Is there a more advanced version of grayscale called RGB? Did grayscale evolve from its predecessor, Dot Matrix? Was the disease created conspiratorially by Epson to rid Westeros of the technologically inclined?
Yes,
I need answers.
Yes to all of the above.
What do you think? I mean, so I feel like that they're positioning grayscale in this show to kind of be whatever they need it to be.
Yeah.
But then there's also a potential that they've only introduced grayscale so they could have the kind of cool action scene and have Jorah contract grayscale for some purpose.
Hmm.
But I honestly don't have enough information to say exactly the particulars of the disease as far as it relates in the show.
Yeah, I think we're just discovering that. And, you know, we speculated earlier about how it could be contagious.
Yeah.
So,
all right, Joel H. So Peter Baelish kicking off another convoluted plan, it seems. I've read some bloggers wonder just what the guy's plan is, like he has something meticulous and foolproof ready to go. But I think we've seen that that's really not how he operates. When he kicked things off, he didn't know how things would go in the wake of John Arryn's death. Just that having the Lysa do so would send the letter to Catelyn blaming the Lannisters would create conflict between the two great houses. Later, after he claimed the dagger used in Bran's assassination attempt belonged to Tyrion, he knew that would stoke tension, but did not know exactly how. He could manipulate Ned with pieces of information about what Jon Arryn was investigating, but his main goal was to create chaos he could use to his advantage. If the show has taught us anything, it's that Baelish thrives on chaos. When things came to a head, he has a plan for whether Ned agreed to his terms or not. In this case, I feel that his current plan has two parts to it. One is taking advantage of the results of the battle up in Winterfell. If the Boltons beat Stannis' forces back, Baelish still has the Force of the Vale he can bring against them. As he notes in one of the DVD's histories of the and lore, the Vale set out in the War of the Five Kings and suffered none of the devastation the rest of the countryside did. Hmm. This isn't just a DVD commentary point. It's also explicit in the show. Lady Lysa refused to take part and raise her banners for anybody.
Yeah.
Because she was afraid for her weak-ass son. It seems unlikely that the Boltons could withstand an attack from Stannis, Westeros' finest surviving military commander, and then another attack from the full strength of the Vale. And I'm sure Baelish is counting on that. Once he defeats the Boltons, he can be seen as either Sansa's savior, assuming she's still alive, or if he's not, a hero to the North, destroying the family that betrayed the Starks. Either way, the North will probably be his. So,
yeah.
If Stannis defeats the Boltons, as Baelish predicts that he would, this brings up a different opportunity. Assuming Sansa vouches to Stannis for Baelish, we may have a united force for the remaining, united force of the remaining forces of the North, the full strength of the Vale, and Stannis' remaining forces ready to march south. Which brings us to the second part of the plan, the Tyrells. Mm-hmm. We know Olivar has been Baelish's man in the past, who works at his brothels and has fed him information, so it's possible his testimony is on Baelish's orders. If it leads to the executions of Loras and Margaery, and Oliver, for that matter, tying up that loose end, you'll have a vengeful Lady Olenna ready to strike at Cersei in any way she can. With Littlefinger's history concerning the Tyrells, first brokering the alliance that allowed the Tyrells and Lannisters to win the War of the Five Kings, and then later helping drive the conspiracy to assassinate Joffrey, Olenna may be willing to withdraw those soldiers' gold and wheat she mentioned to Cersei instead of throwing her support behind the new army coming from the north. The Lannisters would then be besieged in multiple The Lannisters would then be besieged on multiple fronts, and you have to think that Baelish truly plans to rule everything, or if he truly plans to rule everything, he's going to have to take out the strongest house at some point. With Kevin withdrawing to Castle Rock and Cersei ruling as more vulnerable than it's ever been, what do you think of this overall battle plan?
You remember the scene where Littlefinger, Sansa, somebody else are watching Robin practice his sword fighting skills, and he gets a letter. He gets something. Now he takes off, and I assume that was that the carriage was ready to go to Winterfell. When did that happen in comparison to what Olivar's seen? Oliver, whatever.
I assume kind of contemporary. I mean,
like at the same time?
Kind of,
like you think Olivar would have had the opportunity to get word to Littlefinger about what's happening there?
Well, he did get that mysterious raven that they later strongly implied was a marriage proposal.
Yeah.
But it could also have been, you know, something.
We never see it, whereas we see a lot of these other notes.
Yeah.
That's why I'm wondering what was actually on that paper. And he doesn't want Sansa to see it either. Now, I know that leads right into the marriage thing, but
Right.
Makes me wonder, because he would have to know what's going on here. And we haven't really seen that information get to him.
Yeah.
So that would have to happen behind the scenes for him to be helping take down Cersei. Or I'm sorry, take down the Tyrells.
All right. Alicia D. wonders, or his comments, this episode led to a spirited debate between my husband and I over who's the bigger psychopath, Joffrey or Ramsay. Wondering what you and Jim think.
Psychopath? I think Ramsay.
It's interesting because it's like, we saw Ramsay is the seasoned pro, and Joffrey was the talented rookie.
Uh-huh.
So I think that ultimately, being the king, Joffrey could have been a bigger psychopath, but currently he didn't have enough time to fully develop his tastes, and he was just experimenting and like coming into his own. So like, yes, I would have to say Ramsay. But with Joffrey being,
he was cut down in his prime, really. I mean,
he's cut down his prime. But he was more entitled, had more money and more power. So I think he could further indulge his psychopathic tendencies.
Okay. So maybe it's fair to say they're both a little psychopathic, but we saw a little more evidence that Ramsay was better at it.
Yeah, and I think Joff also could be charming. And I know Ramsay can be charming too, but it's not as good. Like, Joff did a better, much better, impressive, I'm a king, and I'm a prince, and I'm...
I feel like Ramsay has a crazier eyes.
Yes.
Like, you look crazier into his face. Eyes, you see crazy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Whereas Joffrey, you see kind of an insolent shit.
Yeah.
Who is power mad, and... Yeah, I don't know. Psychopathic in his own ways, I guess.
Interesting take on Littlefinger from Lily Stark. You guys have been discussing Littlefinger's exact motivation and where his loyalties lie, if he has any, with regards to Sansa. Mm-hmm. When we've debated whether he loves her or not, whether he loves Kat, etc. I think you guys might have alluded to this in Instant Cast a bit, but I wanted you to mention another possible angle. Littlefinger really was in love with Kat, but she did not feel the same. He was not of noble birth. She saw him as just a boy, and she married Ned instead. This is described more in the books, but in the show, he describes this in a long sex position scene to two whores who are furiously finger-fucking each other, so it's a little hard to remember the details. Anyway, perhaps Littlefinger's motivations are less informed by love and more informed by vindictiveness and revenge for the heartbreak and humiliation he suffered. Mm. If not a total explanation for his actions, it could explain his callousness if it turns out that he had sacrificed Sansa simply for his own personal gain.
He loves to hate Catelyn.
Fine line between love and hate. And sacrificing her daughter to the Boltons is a grievous insult.
Yeah.
So we could have this all twisted up, and that would be consistent.
Yeah. Yeah, especially in the beginning when he thought this was the last remaining Stark.
Okay. Moving on to Barrett R. has an updated Yelp review of Littlefinger's brothel. Enjoyed the man-on-man delivery service. Did not care for it when my customer service specialist testified against me in a theological criminal trial in front of my grandma. Foie gras was pretty good, but would not recommend. Sir Loras Tyrell.
Awesome.
One star. Would not broth again. Would not brothel again. Last email. Peter S. It seems to me there's one simple way to keep the ending as it was without selling her character out. While Ramsay was going to town, the camera should have stayed tight in on Sansa's face. Behind the tears, she's got a Catelyn-esque look of grim determination, all but saying, enjoy this while you can, motherfucker, because this is all part of the plan. A big part of the plan involves you waking up one morning soon with your nuts in your mouth. I think this would have fixed everything. Ramsay's still a piece of shit, Theon's still a sniveling wreck, but now Sansa has a certain amount of strength and dignity, even in the midst of the horror she's enduring, and we end on a more or less hopeful note because now we know she's going to make sure Ramsay gets what's coming to him herself.
Just the nuts in his mouth, the cock's going to the cock merchant.
Yeah, I mean, that's a valuable commodity.
Yeah.
Winterfell has many, many
Lord's cock?
Fixes and upkeep that has to be done. Sure, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, but, no, I think flipping it from focus on Theon to focus on Sansa would have been more uncomfortable, yeah. But this might, I don't know, it might have worked better. Hard to say.
Yeah, you could definitely shoot around the full penetration, I'm sure. You could just shoot her face, like he suggests.
Moving on, did you just work in an Always Sunny joke?
I did,
okay,
yeah.
I thought so. I just watched that episode last night, so okay. Captain American, I got that reference. he continues, anyone intrigued by your idea of bald and chain should check out Vicious, a British sitcom starring Sir Ian McKellen and Derek Jacobi as an elderly, constantly bickering gay couple. Hmm. The two of them are fantastic, as you'd expect, but Game of Thrones fans will be particularly interested in the handsome, naive young man they're constantly objectifying and perving on, played by our own Iwan Rheon, Ramsay Snow himself, in a very different kind of role. I'm assuming not as much flaying happens.
Probably.
Or maybe there's a lot of flaying in a metaphorical sense. I don't know.
Huh.
I'm suddenly super interested because I love Ian McKellen.
Yeah.
And this seems really, really something I'd be interested in seeing.
Okay.
If you'd like to send us some more email, again, apologize if I didn't get to yours, but way too much. It's a fire hose at this point. But I try to sift through and find the best, the first, the funniest, the unbent, the unbowed, the unbroken emails, and you can try to sneak your way into our email systems water gardens, which are very lightly guarded, by sending an email to gameofthrones@baldmove.com.
Okay.
I stretched that out enough for
you? No, I like it.
Okay.
It's good.
And then you can also keep in touch with what we're doing on facebook.com/baldmove and on Twitter @baldmove. And check out our forums at forums.baldmove.com. Because the really cool thing about there is we segment the discussion for each episode into spoilers and non-spoiler territory, and it's super fun. And I'm all up in that piece, commenting left, right, and center. Lots of good and smart takes there, too.
I haven't even ventured into our own spoiler-free section
yet. You should not.
Because I'm scared.
You should not.
I'm scared of the spoilers.
That would be ironic. I finally take you off of the listserv for the emails so you don't get spoiled, and then you just blunder into the spoiler-marked thread.
On our own website. That would be bullshit.
What are you doing, Jim Jones? What are you doing? You some kind of sand snake fucking up things left and right.
Yeah, I'm the one with the whip.
You.
All right.
The whippy snake.
And that's it for the show. Thanks, everybody. We're going to be back. Actually, you'll be back with the spoiler.
And Friday. It comes out Friday around noon.
On Friday, yeah. So stay tuned for that.
Still hasn't met the cutoff for that. So if you got a spoiler take or you want to suggest a tinfoil theory or whatever.
Get it in soon, though.
Yeah, I did. Last Friday, I did a show-derived tinfoil that just flamed. It seemed like half of it went down in flames this episode. But
show-derived tinfoil. Okay.
Yeah.
Something that isn't in the books.
Yeah, something that was
completely show speculation. Huh?
Well,
no? Okay.
I can't explain. I mean, sure. What am I going to do? Tell you what I said? That's not going to work.
You're not. All right. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Like I said, Friday. And then, of course, we'll be back right after the episode on Sunday night. Until then, I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron. See ya.